the Friday of the train derailment.
Oh, jeez. Oh, my goodness.
Right when I'm pulling in.
Sand.
I think I'll call...
Well, hi, Mr. Chair. Welcome.
I think I beat you, didn't I? I'm not sure. I was late. I apologize for being late so this gets started. So
no
I'll
worries.
Call this House Interim Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness for September 23rd to order. And so today we have an informational meeting, and we've invited certain people to testify. So first, we have the Oregon Military Department, and welcome, General. I don't know if you've been before our committee before. I don't believe you have yet.
No, first time.
Well, we hope it's a pleasant experience for you.
So do I.
And yourself. I don't guarantee what we may do, but we'll start off with an open mind in that. So welcome, both of you. And
thank you.
Whoever wants to start.
I'll start off here.
Thank you.
As you know, we're here to give you a Cascadia after-action brief. Yeah. For the record, I'm Major General Mike Stenzel, the Adjutant General for the State of Oregon. The formal lessons with regard to this exercise are still yet to be published, but I thought I'd start off, give you a broad overview as what I saw as the key takeaways, and then we'll let Andrew Phelps, the Director of the Office of Emergency Management, go through a brief slideshow in a little bit more detail of what we expect some of those findings might be.
Great.
So starting out, probably the biggest takeaway is that the event of this scale is really going to overwhelm the state resources, and primarily we see that on two fronts. Internally, it's just our ability to respond, both as state agencies and the Oregon National Guard, and then also our ability to receive and distribute external support. What we learned is that all the support agencies at the federal level are essentially going to be stacking up on our border, and it's going to be a real struggle for us to orchestrate and distribute those to the points of need. So we're looking at several avenues to address those, the first being prescriptive mission assignments. The examples I like to give are personnel recovery teams, medical teams, sanitation, things of that nature, so that once we receive those, we can just point them in the right direction, knowing the communication and that will have to be developed later as the time goes, but will allow us to just quickly point and shoot, if you will, and get them to the right area where they need to respond. The next area is really relies around coordination. The three big agencies that you have involved here are FEMA, NORAD, NORTHCOM, as well as the National Guard Bureau in terms of providing support. As these requests come up, and I'll use personnel recovery as another example, it's something that's common to each of these agencies that they could all provide. But as it comes up and it comes through this funnel, it gets filtered in terms of who's going to respond to that. We found that that still really hasn't been wickered out at the national level in terms of who has a best capability and probably closest and most urgent need to get folks out there. So we'll be working that long term as well. Then lastly, I think is a focus on transportation and infrastructure. We really see that as a critical node. You know, obviously the north-south corridor of I-5, our bridges crossing the Columbia, the Willamette, we need to make sure they're sound. Access east-west going over especially the Coast Range, which is most likely going to be hit, is critical. And then as well as looking at our rail and especially our airports. We see with the roads potentially and bridges being down that aerial transport is really going to be the primary mode of response for the first 48, 72 hours. The next area I saw a concern is really our mindset. And as Representative Evans could share, you know, the Guard's perspective is typically one of we are here to support. We wait for the local communities, jurisdictions, to ask for our help, to pull that request from us. And our mindset is not one to come in and take over. We're there to support the local responders. However, with a catastrophe of this scale, what we quickly learned was that we got to change that mindset. It needs to be a mindset of not pull but push. They're really going to be on their knees. And like I said, there's going to be such an overwhelming response that we'd really need to be much more directive in that. We're still supporting, but the mindset is we'll get it to you. If you don't need it, okay, we'll shift it left or right. But we want to get to you as fast as we can. The next area we continue to foot stomp is just personal supplies and readiness. Some states out there, Washington just to our north, learned that you know just three days is not enough. We've been advertising 2 weeks. Arguments can be made that even that's not enough. I think there's potential for it to be months before utilities are actually back in place depending on the extent of the damage. So we're really, you know, this is a citizen-to-citizen support in the first days of this kind of disaster. And unless folks are able to take care of themselves, they're going to be in a tough position to be able to help the rest of their community. The next point I want to make is this exercise stopped, did not go into a long-term recovery. Our focus was on the short term, but it's a focus that you're going to see us picking up as we move forward. It's equally important when you look at evacuation, fatality management, security, all those things long-term that have a huge cost with them, but they're difficult to exercise. But where we can focus is on planning. And so you'll be seeing a lot of encouragement, direction, and advisory work coming from Andrew's folks as we work to develop that further down the road. And then lastly, I know all of you know this, but the challenge is going to be resourcing. When you look at resiliency, it costs money. And there's a lot of competing priorities, you know, whether it's this Capitol building, schools, bridges. Fortunately for me, that's for the legislature to decide where those priorities will be. But spending on resiliency today is clearly going to save exponentially in the long term. And I feel I owe it to remind everybody to keep that thought in mind as you do go to balance those priorities. With that, I'm going to pass it on to Andrew to give you a more detailed look.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you, General Andrew.
Thank you, sir. Chair Lively, members of the committee, my name is Andrew Phelps. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Emergency Management. And someday I'd like to sit up here and talk about rainbows and unicorns. But today
not that. We'll see if we can squeeze that in somewhere.
Just to recap quickly, the scenario that we exercised in early June depicted a 9.0 magnitude earthquake along the Cascadia subduction zone, resulting in numerous tsunamis and extensive damage throughout the state of Oregon, especially along the coast and along the Interstate 5 corridor. We do these exercises for a number of reasons. First and foremost is to identify areas for us to improve, areas for us to focus our resources, our limited resources, to make sure that we're prepared to respond to whatever emergency or crisis may impact the state of Oregon. I am pleased to report that this exercise garnered unprecedented participation at the local level, the tribal level, with our state partners, our federal partners, and with nonprofit and private sector integration. We had all 23 Governor Disaster Cabinet agencies participate in two meetings to coordinate policy level issues. We had all of Oregon's nine tribes participate in the exercise. We had 17 state agencies represented at the Emergency Coordination Center here in Salem, and 26 local jurisdictions participated. Across the breadth of the exercise in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and British Columbia, they estimate there were over 20,000 participants at some point during the four-day exercise. So an incredible undertaking and really one of the largest exercise initiatives Oregon has ever undertaken. Just planning for the exercise, I think, made us better prepared to plan for other disasters, if you will. A couple of the high-level strengths. This was the first opportunity for the governor's disaster cabinet, which was created via an executive order in March, to come together and discuss policy issues as they pertain to a disaster response and recovery scenario. Having high-level participation from each of the 23 Oregon Emergency Response System agencies and the governor's office in that body was tremendous, and it showed, I think, a very high level of support for what we as a state are trying to do to ensure a timely and accurate and effective response to any disaster here in the state of Oregon. The second point I want to highlight is the federal and state integration. Although we do frequently interact with incident management teams, federal incident management teams in the wildfire environment, we don't have that opportunity very often in a all-hazards disaster environment where we bring in an incident management team from the federal level to interface with our state partners at the Emergency Coordination Center. The good news is we don't have those types of disasters very frequently where we're relying on federal response resources. The downside to that is we don't get to exercise that capability very often at all. The flexibility shown both by our federal partners and our state folks in integrating with a system that we don't have a lot of familiarity with was astounding to watch. General Stencil mentioned our two-week preparedness messaging. This wasn't an official objective for us to evaluate, but we looked around on day three of the exercise, and traditional preparedness messaging across the country is 3 days of preparedness. After 3 days, there were still, and we anticipate there would be, jurisdictions that we don't know if they have a leadership structure in place. We may not have established communications with those jurisdictions. So for us to say that all you need is 3 days of food, water, and medication is at best disingenuous. I think our perspective of 2 weeks preparedness plus is an appropriate message for us to carry forward. We're looking at ways to make that more digestible, breaking it down to even further bite-sized pieces. What do folks need the first 2 minutes after disaster, the first 2 hours after disaster, 2 days, and then working towards 2 weeks. A sort of intangible in a disaster situation is the flexibility and problem-solving capacity that staff have. As much planning and training and exercising as we do to prepare for events like this, there's always things that pop up that maybe we didn't consider, didn't spend enough time mulling over what our responses or our actions or our policy decisions would be. Staff and leadership being nimble and flexible in their decision-making, evaluating very limited information and making decisions with probably 20%, 30% of the information that we would really like to have to make those decisions was something that I think really shaped the response that we found here in Salem and across the state. Areas for improvement. This is a huge disaster. This isn't an Oregon disaster. This isn't a Pacific Northwest disaster. This is a national, if not international, disaster. The amount of resources we expect to need here in Oregon are tremendous. I often say I'm less interested in what Oregon will be doing during a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake and much more interested to know what Colorado or Texas will be doing, because that's where a lot of our resources will be coming from, other states. You see in the graphic there the flow of resources and information and requests. This disaster illustrated for me a complete 180-degree shift in how we approach resource allocation and resource processing during a disaster. Typically, the request comes from a local jurisdiction up to a county. If the county can't handle it, the state works that issue and so on up to the feds. Given the likelihood that we won't know what response capacity exists in many of our jurisdictions, we need to be better positioned both to push resources to local jurisdictions without an ask, and we need to be prepared to receive federal resources that we maybe haven't asked for but are coming anyway. This is something I think that can be achieved through planning, through coordination with other states, through making sure we have robust mutual aid agreements, and processes in place to track those resources. Situational awareness and situation reporting is a challenge, I think, in emergencies big and small, from a car accident and a 911 call that may or may not provide accurate information to a disaster like a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. You run the chance of having either too much information or not enough information. Being able to distill what information is important, analyze that information, and package that information so it's easily digestible by leadership and policymakers is important. I think after day three of this exercise, we had about a 30-page situation report. Trying to glean much useful information out of a report that big can be a challenge, especially when the ground is still shaking every 30 minutes or so with aftershocks. So we have a ways to go, I think, on how we collect and disseminate and analyze information in a disaster. Communications are always a challenge. I've never participated in an exercise where there wasn't a delta in the communications front. We learned very quickly that satellite phones, though a great resource and nice to have, aren't as convenient or efficient or effective as a cell phone that we've all become accustomed to. Looking at secondary and tertiary means of communication, our amateur radio folks that supported the exercise were tremendous. I encourage everyone to think about getting an amateur radio license, and we're looking at expanding ways that we can get amateur radio out into the field even more. Our operational facilities and continuity of operations plans, we haven't done a lot to test our continuity of operations planning. We were blessed with the exercise designers on day four of the exercise by being told the structure that you're operating in is no longer sound, you need to relocate. This told us that whenever we activate our emergency coordination center in Salem, we need to also activate a secondary location. So if we need to relocate in a hurry, we're not trying to go through those motions when it's a little bit too late to do that. The final opportunity for improvement that we've identified, again, at a very high level, is expanding the Oregon Emergency Response System, or OERS. We currently have 22 state agencies that are participants in the Oregon Emergency Response System. We've introduced a legislative concept that will add 10 additional state agencies as well as the Secretary of State's office to the Oregon Emergency Response System. Suffice it to say, every state agency has a role to play during a disaster for response and recovery, but we want to make sure that these agencies are being involved early in the process and as part of the planning process so that we're not making assumptions at the state level about what they can and can't do, where the areas of responsibility lie. Collaboration and engagement across the state enterprises is going to be critical to our success for any disaster. All emergencies, I think, come down to the capacity to respond. I said to myself time and time again, whether I was briefing staff during the Emergency Coordination Center activation or in my video teleconference conversations with FEMA Administrator Fugate, whatever we've got, we're going to need more. Of course, it's not enough for us to say that and just ask for people to send more of everything. We need to be very specific with what we're asking. But I think through the development of mission-ready packages, prescripted resource requests, things that once the ground starts shaking, this response both through the state and through the nation becomes automatic is going to be important. When you make a 911 call because of a structure fire, a dispatcher isn't sitting there thinking, well, what kind of fire engine should I send? How many police cars and ambulances should I send? They essentially tone out the structure fire response and those resources start moving. We need to have that same perspective for catastrophic resource response here in the state of Oregon. I mentioned this is also a national and international event. The graphic in the slide shows communication networks between Asia and the United States. Many of those networks come through Oregon. That's both a literal and figurative slide. If something bad happens here in Oregon, especially something that impacts the Pacific Northwest, there are economic impacts globally. There are communications impacts globally. There are trade impacts globally. For us to think that this is a regional problem isn't going to get us to where I think we need to be. So ensuring that we're working with our national and international partners to effect a positive response, supporting the Federal Emergency Management Agency's effort to change the Stafford Act to allow international search and rescue teams to be deployed to the United States during a disaster goes a huge way to solving some of those problems and challenges. Prescripted messages are essential. The less thinking, the less menu gazing we're going to have to do during a disaster, the better off we'll be. Similarly, the investments we make now in preparedness and in mitigation, reducing what we have to respond to during a disaster is going to pay dividends in that disaster response. If we can harden bridges, other infrastructure, our hospitals, our schools, those are pieces of infrastructure that both we can rely on during a disaster and that we don't need to expend resources responding to a secondary emergency because of a failure of those pieces of infrastructure. Finally, in conclusion, our after-action review process is well underway. The after-action review process actually started the day the exercise began with our evaluators checking off boxes of what they were expecting exercise players to do versus what actually occurred. That evaluation continues to this day. We had hoped to have our final report available by September 30th. That date actually was exceeded. We had our after-action meeting up at Camp Withicum earlier this week on the 20th of September. That document is going under final review by all state agency stakeholder partners, and we'll have that final document released in a couple of weeks. So that's all I've got now, pending any questions, sir.
Thank you. Very much. Do you have something further?
No, sir, just as he noted, when we get that final report, we're happy to share it with you. But if there were to be any big three here, say number one is we just need to look to increase capacity and coordination. Again, changing our mindset from kind of that pull to a push. And it's not just for the National Guard, but I say the state as a whole. And then pre-planning. I just can't foot stomp it enough. Thinking it in front and getting ahead of this.
Sure. And I know that Representative Evans, I went out for a while. I know Representative Evans and other people did, but it was pretty interesting to see it on in action as the exercise was going on. But one of the comments I would make here, well, this exercise was around the earthquake. As we look at events and things occurring, what we know is this effort has a lot to do with things besides earthquake, because whether it's floods or massive forest fires or things. We see it around us in the country. These things happen where we could have to implement the types of things we've talked about here. So the more we learn, the quicker, the more chance we have. But as I looked at that, I thought, well, the odds of that and where that's at is far out there, but there's a whole bunch of other tragedies, catastrophes in that we may face as a state. So these efforts, doing the exercises, and that helps. And I think the point of the local preparedness, I've seen a lot of things recently, locally, as they've talked about it, and the issue about how many days and what is being, it's all over the place, but most people have realized that 72 hours or whatever probably isn't nearly enough given what might happen. So, Representative Evans, did you have?
Thank you, Chair. I just want to make a comment and ask her, make a comment and a request. First is I want to commend you for the overall approach. The things you put forward, I think, are a reflection of a lot of hard work to get us to where we are now. And I know that the economic recession that eroded some of our capacity several years back took a while to fill back in. But it's clear that you guys are moving forward, and I want to commend you for that. The question I have, everything you said makes sense. You alluded to something that I'd like to kind of hear the actual words so we can also discuss it moving forward. In the pre-planning, one of the frustrating things, at least several years back, was if you knew a disaster was coming, but it was one of those situations where it might hit here, it might hit there. There was generally a concern of before you deploy the assets, you want to make sure, because of the way that things are reimbursed, you let it hit first before you start rolling the stock. And we had talked about, through creation of the Oregon Disaster Relief Fund, which I think still exists, but I don't think there's any money in it, the ability to basically say, all right, we're going to accept the risk that sometimes we may roll it and the windstorm may not come that way, it may come the other. But if it's there and when it hits, it'll save lives. So that pre-event authorization to roll stock so that you're actually pre-staged, it was a concern because just the way the legislature reimburses, there was a movement to try to give authority to do that. Is that something you're looking at again? He asks, hopefully.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, Representative Evans. Yes.
I think that's a wonderful answer. That's a great answer. Yes.
That was a good answer.
During the exercise, I sort of realized if and when this thing hits, I'm going to be giving testimony for a long time about a lot of things. I'm much more comfortable sitting up here explaining why I sent resources that weren't requested as opposed to why I had resources that I didn't send that were desperately needed.
So I have a little bit different concerns. You know, it's great we talk about having 72 hours or 2 weeks or whatever. My house is like a bomb shelter, so my friends joke that they're coming to my house. But I have real concerns when we have nearly one in four of our Oregonians is on food stamps, and, you know, and they can't afford 2 days worth of food, let alone have a 2 week supply. You know, our homeless population who's transient, or, you know, folks who don't have the ability to have resources. I mean, do we have, or are we working towards some kind of grassroots plan that would help educate that population that, you know, in the midst of everything else, at least you might not have a 2 week supply. Here's, you know, here's where you're going to go when that happens, if that happens and you don't have the resources, because it's great if you can afford, you know, to fill your backpacks and have a plan, but a lot of people don't have a backpack. So, and that is a big chunk of our state. And so I want to see that we are making efforts to do outreach into our lowest income communities to connect them to the fact that this is a real thing. And you may not be able to afford 2 weeks, but if something happens, here's where you go. And I don't know if that's, if we're tied into like a 211 for a response. I don't know if it's, you know, I don't know where we're going to direct people. But I think that if we're not working towards a plan that is inclusive of our lowest income populations, and we saw that happen in Katrina, we saw where people in the Ninth Ward were just stuck. And so how do we solve that? And I don't have the answer, but I'm curious if anybody else is thinking about that, because I think that hasn't come up. And I've been on this committee for 6 years, and I don't think that's come up in the dialogue, is how do you get to the people who are really, you know, going to be impacted the worst? And there's a lot of them.
If I may, Chair Lively, Representative Parrish, we do recognize that, and I wholeheartedly agree. That's a large part of what's behind my reference in terms of preparedness, knowing that exponentially you're going to save a lot of money down the road if you can take those kind of steps. When it comes to preparing food supplies, frankly, part of the reason we settle on 2 weeks is just the practicality of asking a lot of folks. You know, 30 days, frankly, would be much more my comfort level, but that's not practical for most of our population. And that's why it's so important to make sure that transportation avenues, roads and everything are at a level of durability that we can assure that we can get convoys, helicopters, and other means there to get food supplies and resources into those populations.
But how do they know? I guess that's the question. I'm going to follow that up. Sorry. How do they know? How do they know where they're going to turn, who that person is? I mean, I think about my own community where we have, you know, a small police force. They're going to be tapped. And, you know, and so as your local on the ground, the EMT first responders are going to be super busy. How does that just average Oregon citizen who's really struggling right now, I mean, how do we educate them about where to go now, ahead of time, and really make that an effort? I'm like struggling wrapping my brain around that.
Chair Livey, Representative Parrish. There's a couple of components, I think, that help us address that problem. The first is with our messaging that we do at a state and local level. Preparedness is more than just stuff. I think we make a big show of stuff in the pictures of 14 gallons of water for everybody and these kits that you can spend hundreds of dollars on. But you're absolutely right. There's Oregonians that don't know they're going to put food on the table tonight for dinner. And to tell them to put 2 weeks of food in a closet someplace just in case is a difficult message for us to communicate. It comes down, I think, to the messaging that it's more than stuff. It's what you know, what you can do, access to those resources, where those resources are, the knowledge, I think, that folks need to take care of themselves in an emergency, basic first aid, some of those types of initiatives can go a long way. It's reinforced also, I think, by the partnerships we're continuing to build with our Volunteer Organizations Active in Disaster, our VOAD community, our faith-based and nonprofit community. Those are organizations that have outreach existing to a lot of those underserved communities and those communities of need, including them in the dialogue as we prepare what their role would be in a disaster, what the food banks are going to be doing during a disaster. It's very similar to their mission on a blue sky day, but it's amplified during a disaster. We at OEM don't want to be in the business of collecting and distributing food to Oregon's underserved population during a disaster. We don't want to do that because there's organizations that are already really, really good at doing that. So our participation in the Oregon VOAD community, the planning efforts that we're doing, and emphasizing how important it is for those of us that can prepare for 2 weeks, should prepare, freeing up resources for those that don't have the capacity to prepare today for a bad day tomorrow.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Parrish has kind of hit on something that I think, you know, we were talking about the 1 in 4 that can't afford it, but what about the 3 in 4 that can, that are unaware of it and or aren't really concerned about it? You asked this panel up here, and we're very attuned to it, and some of us have enough, some of us don't have enough reserve. The other thing that we look at, Representative, I think they have to be a little fluid of what they're going to, how they're going to go about it, where you're going to go about it, because it depends what's standing. I mean, we don't even know when this thing hits, and it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. The other thing that I see is that, you know, if you ask Joe Blow and his wife out here on the street, they don't have any reserve. They know nothing about this. So how are we going to educate people so they're at least aware of it? Because I ask people in my community all the time, and they're going, well, I don't know. Yeah. And I don't have anything in reserve except what's on my shelf in my home or my refrigerator. The other thing that, the desperate thing is how are you gonna get water to people? Because, you know, 3 days, you're in trouble. So, and it's not necessarily your job to get the water to people, but we need to educate the public so they can take care of themselves for a certain period of time. And I want to know how we can do that, because that to me is more important than what government can do, because government can't immediately shift gears and take care of 1.2 million people. I mean, that's, we can't do that. People have to take care of themselves, and we have to educate them so they understand what they need to do. I turned in a report, I thought it was pretty extensive, on people, on how, what they need to do to prepare themselves for this, because this is going to happen. It's going to happen.
If I may, Chair Lively, Representative Esquivel, I couldn't agree more. I know this messaging has been happening for most of my career in the National Guard, and yet for some reason, out of the blue, an article from the New Yorker on the East Coast seemed to grab everybody's attention on the West Coast. What I've been happy to see is how folks have capitalized on that effort, and it's everything from PBS to local radio stations. It's been heartwarming to hear people jump on that bandwagon and continue to sell that story, and I think it's a great opportunity for us continue to ride that bandwagon as well and really view this as a whole of government type of approach to get that message out.
Well, Paul, mm-hmm. we need to make sure that it's from the grassroots level up instead of the top down, that approach, because the people have to take care of themselves, and they're going to have to prepare for themselves. That's just my opinion, because I don't think we can take care of that many people.
Chair Levy, Representative Esquivel, in all of my message, I always include a segment that describes this as a citizen-to-citizen response. The danger in us continuing to talk about the government response and what you're going to hear from the National Guard is that people assume that they don't have to worry.
That's right.
The National Guard and government's going to be
false
there.
False security blanket.
Exactly. Exactly. So we're attuned to that difficulty.
Did you? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had a training exercise in the gorge this summer. We called it the oil train derailment. And unplanned, of course. Could have been a lot bigger situation than it was, thank goodness. But what happened was I-84 was shut down, east and westbound, virtually immediately. Traffic went to where they thought they could get around, so almost immediately Highway 14, one lane each direction, was at a standstill. Accidents were happening and traffic was stalled. So I recently had the privilege of spending a couple of glorious nights over on our Oregon coast, and I was staying right on the beach. And I was sitting on the deck one evening with my glass of wine, looking out at the rolling waves, thinking, if the tsunami tower goes off that was at the end of the building, how much time am I going to have to get off my deck, get down to the car, and get out to, by that time, an already jammed highway? And like Rep Perry said, you know, she's been here 6 years. Even in that amount of time, we have, and we're not even on the committees, we have sat through hours and potentially possibly days of reports like this, and even more extensive. And I just wonder how are we going to handle Seaside, Cannon Beach? That's a good example, Seaside and Cannon Beach, because they funnel into one highway. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, your bottleneck really gets exacerbated in that scenario. And all of us that make an occasional trip through Portland understand that even multi-lane highways at certain hours of the day, growing number of hours in the day, become parking lots. Oftentimes, it can be because of the best intentions of law enforcement wanting to take care of a situation. They're off on the side of the road with their lights on. And when you get up to that spot, a half hour later, because you've been crawling, you find out that a small situation where a public safety officer was doing their job, but because their lights flashing, everybody came to a screeching halt. I mean, it's little things like that that I'm just wondering the practicality with all of our planning. How's it really going to work? When is the tsunami signal going to get the signal? And in practicality, do folks in those coastal communities have 30 minutes from the warning? Do they have an hour? You know, how soon do we know what's going on out there in the ocean to give a warning? And in a practical measure, how are we going to funnel people out if they have time? Those are the things the last couple of weeks and a couple of months since the oil train derailment and practical things like, you know, my hospital was having to fly doctors from Hood River to the Dalles because the roads were closed. So, you know, a lot of those things that you may not necessarily think about, but you have a real situation, and then it's like, wow, you know, we had a pretty good plan, but now we've got a lot of other things we need to figure out. And I know we're never going to figure everything out. I get it. But those are the things that, since the oil train derailment and sitting there on the beach looking out thinking, wow, what would my chances be of really getting out of town before the wave comes?
I mean, you're not going back to the beach? Or?
It was two glorious nights. And I don't want to say anything to hurt tourism.
No, you don't.
Go ahead. If I could, just the thing that impresses me most about the approach you have is it reflects some of the lessons we learned the hard way in December of 07 and 08 when we actually had the windstorm happen. And the questions that Representative Huffman raised are certainly on everybody's mind, and I hope that we can continue working toward at least a better idea of what the WAG would be to have that idea. That said, given the fact that we don't have unlimited dollars, or we have limited dollars, the idea of emphasizing response and recovery capacity that resets the table and can try to meet the needs after an event, be it caused by terrorism or seismic or fire or whatever, I think is a good exercise for everybody because it builds overall resiliency. And hopefully in the pursuit of that universalist approach across the state, we can find some of those answers as we try to get more tailored moving forward. But it is going to be a massive undertaking that will often frustrate us because we won't have some of those answers. The good news is, at least if we're starting to recognize that infrastructure, nodes of support, flowing goods and materials, pre-staging, pre-thinking what they're going to need, response packages, I think those are all on the right path. So I'm actually far more encouraged about today than I would be, though I still have no idea if I'm standing on the beach if I'll ever get to return to it. I mean, I get that point.
But Representative Evans, that kind of gets back to the point of resourcing and why we're doing exercises. Is frankly, it's the most economical bang for the buck is doing a large exercise like this. But they still need to be done at the local level to include tsunami evacuation and standing up your county and local emergency operations centers and walking through those steps.
Yes, I think in order for us to understand what we'd be dealing with on the coast, you need to go to the 1964 earthquake in Alaska and look at the pictures. Mm-hmm. You're not going to drive a car. You're not going to have a problem with a car because you can't drive on any infrastructure because it'll be gone. You know. In fact, I was in the service with a guy that said, you know, he said the roadways went 20 feet up in the air, and then all of a sudden you were 20 feet above that roadway. It was shifting. And the devastation was unbelievable. They had no infrastructure left in that particular earthquake. That was 9.2. So it's kind of the same magnitude that we're talking about, the same area. So the concern is how would you delivery and escape. That's going to be very difficult for people.
I felt better after Representative Evans' comments. Now you've kind of put me down the other track, and it's not so good. Sorry.
And as for you getting off the deck, you may get off that deck quicker than you think.
With some help. We had an event in our community. Our Rotary Club put it on, and they went out and paid for the buckets, and people showed up. It was great. But, you know, I don't know how we make resource grants available to communities that want to do the work. I don't know if those dollars exist out there. We need to give them some of those dollars. But I think they probably had a couple hundred people show out. They, you know, got like a Home Depot bucket, and it had, you know, some water tablets in it, and it had just stuff. But they had to come out and kind of learn and listen, and then they got their bucket. And so I, you know, I don't know how we put more of that boots on the grass up, you know, from the ground up kind of way, grassroots rather than, you know, the top down side. But that takes some resources. And I think if we're going to be serious about this, we might think about how we put community, you know, resources out to Rotary clubs or Lions clubs or whoever wants to do the work in their community and make that available. But I thought it was a very effective way to get that message out, and our papers picked up on it. And you know, the other thing I was going to say, we've got all kinds of ads, you know, on television that the government puts out. You know, the lottery does good things and everything else. Never see like a, you know, get yourself prepared TV ad coming out of our state and that kind of awareness. I know individually OPB and others have sort of banged that drum for us, but I think at some point we're probably going to need a concerted advertising type campaign that says, you know, get your bucket and be ready or whatever that message is. So.
So I have a question. I want to go kind of back to the beginning of this. So we've had the emergency, and I appreciate the exercise. And when I saw the exercise, we were quite a ways into it already. It wasn't, but at the very beginning, and something you said, General, I'm trying to understand. So it's National Guard, and the National Guard people aren't standing in the station waiting for an emergency. They're all over the state. And so I'm trying to understand what the first series of events that when the event happens, how long does it take to get organized to where whatever response we're going to do, that we're having some kind of response, and whether it's the National Guard or it's the other government facilities, because everybody's off doing what they're supposed to be doing. So maybe I'll pick on the National Guard first just to try to understand.
Sure. And Chair Lively, bottom line is I can't give you an accurate answer, not knowing, you know, the extent of the damage. You know, even for the civilian population, and we kind of use the same statistical numbers for the Guard, too, we're potentially looking at as down to 25% of our folks being able to respond on short notice. But everybody understands that there will be a quick recall that goes underway. And if there's not communication, to show up their closest armory so that they can collectively get together and combine for a large-scale response. But the reality is that from a state perspective, we're going to be overwhelmed. We know that. We saw that in Katrina, Sandy. It's going to be a minimum a regional disaster and potentially national. So we are going to have to reach outside our state for additional help.
But the reality is people just understand nothing's going to happen instantly.
Correct.
And so it goes back to how long people can depend on themselves or their local communities. But not from the state. So one of the comments you made, Andrew, I think, was this, the Oregon Emergency Response System. And I was a little confused. Why aren't all the departments in that part of that to begin with?
That's a great question. Without the background, I can't speak terribly intelligently to it. I do know that we've selected or identified primarily the agencies that have a real clear role to play in emergency response, Department of Transportation, State Police. I think as our response posture and our planning posture has evolved, we've seen a whole host of reasons why other state agencies need to be included. I've had great conversations recently with Travel Oregon, a state agency that, gosh, I'd be pretty hard-pressed to figure out how we're going to rely on those folks during a disaster. But we're talking with them about planning for next summer's eclipse and the impacts that we're going to have here in Oregon with the folks that are coming to Oregon to view that event, and how we can collaborate on preparedness messaging, finding a repository for a list of events and expected attendance at those events. So, you know, I think we've taken this posture at the Office of Emergency Management where we're being very inclusive and not exclusive. I'm encouraged by both how we're able to incorporate different disciplines into the emergency planning process, and I'm equally encouraged by the level of interest that we're seeing from agencies that typically maybe didn't think a whole lot about what their role would be during a disaster, and we're starting to see a shift in that, and I appreciate that.
We have a disaster, and so the first thing that has to happen is a declaration by the governor or by the president. Where does it start?
Great question. The disaster declaration isn't needed necessarily to facilitate the movement of response resources.
Okay.
However, that is a process that needs to be followed to request federal resources. And that can happen very quickly. In the case of this disaster, and actually we'll take a real-world event, the recent flooding in Louisiana. That flooding began, and the president had responded to the governor's request for a disaster declaration within 24 hours. A lot of those things start spinning up. FEMA, under Administrator Fugate, has a very forward-leaning posture where if they think something is happening and they haven't even heard whether or not the state needs resources,
no,
they're
going to
start
okay,
leaning very forward.
And Chair, I have that authority as well. I would immediately have people
okay,
responding.
Okay. Any other questions?
Just we can, in fact, a municipality can declare an emergency, a county can declare an emergency, then it defaults back to the governor for the governor to react accordingly. Is that correct?
Chair Lively, member of the committee, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Anything further? Thank you very much. And again, I appreciate the update and look forward to the final report on the lessons learned.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
More comfortable
on a single seat fire. I know. You might want to move one of the microphones over closer to this just so we get the recording.
All right. So, would you like to go ahead and launch on my update for the Guardian?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, again, for the record, I'm Major General Mike Stensel, Adjutant General for the Oregon National Guard. I've been dual status guardsman for most of my career, having risen through the ranks of the Oregon Air National Guard. I was named by Governor Brown as Adjutant General a year ago this month, following Lieutenant General Hokanson's appointment as the NORAD NORTHCOM Deputy Commander. I'm happy to share that last week he was confirmed as the Vice Chief of the National Guard Bureau.
Nice.
I could not be more proud that an Oregon Guardsman is now going to be the number two leader of our nation's National Guard Bureau. The Oregon National Guard is first and foremost a community-based organization, manned by citizens of this state who are committed to making Oregon, as well as the nation, a safer, more resilient place to live. We're an organization spanning 53 locations across the state with two air bases, 38 armories, and 13 training and logistics sites. As Guard men and women, we contribute to our state and nation on three fronts. On the home front, doing everything from protecting the skies of the Pacific Northwest to orchestrating emergency management through OEM, as we previously discussed, and through the warfight, deploying our soldiers and airmen in support of national objectives abroad, and lastly, through partnerships, not just locally and within the state, but nationally and internationally as well. I inherited a great legacy, but like any organization, we cannot rely on our past accomplishments to carry us into the future. The current environment is filled with challenges as well as opportunities. To ensure that we are aligned to build on this proud history, I've asked both the Army and Air Components and the Office of Emergency Management to review their existing strategic guidance to ensure the Oregon Military Department is headed in a direction that assures our relevance well into the future and positions OEM to lead in coordinating a domestic response for our fellow Oregonians. To that end, I have outlined seven basic priorities to guide us in our daily activities. Emphasis on our core values, leadership, readiness, partnerships, resiliency, preparedness, and stewardship. But before addressing these priorities individually, I want to first explain the national and international framework in which I view them. The state and federal environment in which we operate has wide-reaching implications for our future. Internationally, in the Department of Defense, we refer to our primary threats as the 4+1: Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, and violent extremism. What makes this time in our history unique is that these threats are now transnational, they cross multiple domains, and they operate at extraordinary speed. They extend beyond air, land, and sea, now into space, cyberspace, and even our economy. They extend close to our international borders, as witnessed by intercepts of Russian bombers off of our very own shoreline. Our ability to respond is further complicated by declining budgets and resources. Having been at war for more than a decade, modernization has been deferred for years, but it can no longer be ignored. Financially, from FY14 to 15, the Oregon Army National Guard's federal budget shrank roughly 15%, from $171 to $144 million. Over that same time frame, the Oregon Air Guard's federal budget shrank from $154 to $148 million. Additionally, the end strength of the nation's Army National Guard is proposed to shrink from 342 to 335,000 this coming year. Oregon is expected to share in that reduction, but the impact is yet to be determined. The days of the National Guard being a strategic reserve are well behind us. We are now unequivocally an operational reserve, with nearly half of the National Guard having been in combat experience. As General Milley, the Army Chief of Staff, has noted, the Army cannot go to war without the Army National Guard. The same can be said for our Air Force, where in 2015, the Air Guard performed 30% of the Air Force mission each day and is ready to deploy worldwide within 72 hours. The Air Guard also provides 70% of the Air Force's expeditionary communications and wartime traffic control capability, and the National Guard provides more than 70% of DOD's chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear response capability. This continued reliance on the National Guard will ultimately drive an ever-increasing contribution on the part of the Oregon National Guard, as we, too, continue to take on more of an operational role. So it's within this threat, budgetary, and operational environment that we laid out our priorities that I introduced earlier. I would now like to address them in more detail, starting with our emphasis on knowing and modeling our core values. In the Oregon National Guard, these are character, competence, courage, and commitment. These traits are our moral foundation, and they define us as a profession. Without them, we risk losing the public trust on which we so intimately rely. It's not to say that we don't err now and then, but as co-workers, battle buddies, and wingmen, we work daily to ingrain our core values into our culture. My second priority is leadership, empowering and calling upon every soldier, airman, and civilian to be a leader in this organization, no matter their position or rank. We need critical thinkers who will take initiative, demonstrate core values, and take our organization to the next level. I do not believe that leadership needs to be command-centric. I think anyone can be a leader. While our members may not be in a formal leadership position, they are always in a position to lead. With regard to readiness, developing and maintaining trained, ready, and experienced forces for our state and nation is the heart of our mission. Each component of the Oregon Military Department has its own readiness challenges. Within the Oregon Army National Guard, recruiting and retention is my number one priority. I want to posture the Oregon Army National Guard to prevent sharing the potential force structure cuts that I previously seen. Excuse me. Give me a quick drink here. Too much talking. To participate in those force structure cuts within the Army National Guard, and our manning is going to be an integral part of that decision. Armory sustainment modernization is a critical component of Oregon Army National Guard readiness as well. The average age of our armories is 37 years, with deferred maintenance assessed at more than $134 million. Our agency has submitted several policy packages for consideration in the governor's budget to address this issue. We have submitted a deferred maintenance package valued at $6.1 million in federal funds, with $6.1 million of state matching general fund. And we have submitted a regional Army emergency enhancement package that will play a vital role in emergency response as well. It's for $16.4 million in bonding authority for our armories in Newport, Coos Bay, the Anderson Readiness Center, and Salem Army Aviation Support Facility. There's one more policy package regarding the indoor firing ranges that I will address later in my remarks. There are a number of initiatives that have changed the structure and types of units in the Oregon National Guard, two of which I want to highlight for you. Within the Army National Guard, next spring we are scheduled to receive Stryker vehicles. The Stryker conversion includes swapping missions of battalion-sized units within the Army National Guard. We give up a Humvee mission-based cavalry battalion headquartered in Bend and in turn receive a Stryker-based battalion. As a benefit to Oregon, this unit will have greater speed and command and control capability, off-road mobility, and provide a larger evacuation capacity than our Humvees. Readiness priorities within the Oregon Air National Guard predominantly revolve around the F-15 C&D model and its life expectancy. Future modernization programs for our F-15s include upgrades to the Advanced Electronic Scanned Array Radar, enhanced electronic warfare and self-protection suites, and cockpit avionics modernization. An F-15 C&D service life extension program, commonly referred to as SLEP, for replacing major aircraft structural components is also under consideration. The Chief of Staff of the Air Force is expected to announce how many aircraft will go through this life extension and when it will begin, sometimes next year. It is expected to extend the service lives of the aircraft to 2045 at an estimated cost, though, of $10 to $12 billion. For your awareness, our Portland-based F-15s are the only fighters that are guarding the skies of the Pacific Northwest, and the Klamath Falls unit trains all the F-15 air-to-air pilots in both active duty and the Air National Guard. A delay bridged to our next generation of combat aircraft could create a lethal vulnerability to the defense of the United States. The forging and maintenance of partnerships cannot be overemphasized. Relationships across our communities, within our state, across the nation, and across the globe are invaluable. The economic contribution to the state from our federal missions is significant. Total federal annual payroll contributions to the Oregon National Guard were just over $273 million in FY15, with annual supplies and services contributions at just over $65 million. These contributions equate to millions of dollars in state income tax contributions, as well as economic support to our communities. In the last year, the Oregon National Guard has continued to support overseas deployments and operations. Some of these missions, like the European Reassurance Initiative, were necessitated to show support and train with the United States European partners in light of Soviet transgressions. The Oregon Air Guard deployed several hundred personnel and F-15 aircraft to both Romania and Finland, combat controllers to the United Arab Emirates, and security forces to Kuwait, while the Oregon Army Guard deployed their CH-47 helicopter unit to Kuwait, which included considerable activity up north in Iraq. On the home front, last summer, the Oregon National Guard provided 524 service members to fight forest fires within our state. In addition, Oregon service members have supported 22 search and rescue missions over the last 2 years, and almost weekly requests of explosive ordnance disposal personnel in support of local law enforcement. Our Civil Support Team, or CST, has supported the Indoor Track and Field Championships and the U.S. Olympic Trials. They provided radiological assessment of civilian cargo ships off the Oregon coast and responded to white powder emergencies across the state. The Oregon National Guard's strategic partnerships with the countries of Vietnam and Bangladesh are truly unique military-to-military relationships. The Vietnamese partnership continues to grow beyond the military arena. The Oregon National Guard is a collaborative member of the Vietnam-Oregon Initiative led by Portland State University. This whole-of-government approach to a broader and comprehensive Oregon-Vietnam partnership is meant to collectively build upon each other's contacts with Vietnam and increase opportunities in trade, higher education, and more. And much like Vietnam, U.S. Pacific Command looks to the Oregon National Guard as an enduring partner with Bangladesh. However, the Oregon National Guard-Bangladesh partnership is concentrated on efforts seen as more traditional mill-to-mill engagement. Over the last year, some of our primary accomplishments involve solidifying a multi-year plan for non-commissioned officer development programs and enhancing the advancement of women within the Bangladeshi military, as well as conducting border guard training at our own Camp Rylea. The contribution of these programs to relationship buildings between our countries cannot be overstated. Our operational tempo and wartime experience can wear on some of our service members. Recognizing the challenges of military life, we have dedicated resources and put support programs in place to build resiliency, not only for the service member, but for their families, employers as well. We invest heavily in the OMD community, trying to foster a resilient culture built on our core values. Resiliency is at the forefront of preventing one of the most tragic events, suicide. Suicide prevention will always be a priority, and we work hard to ensure that we have the proper education, training, and availability of mental health professionals to build resilient soldiers and airmen. Beyond heightened emphasis on staying genuinely attuned with our service members, resource tools available to Oregon Guardsmen include access to financial counseling, professional agency referral programs, crisis lines, education and job assistance, military youth programs, and strong bonds relationship seminars. Oregon has been fortunate as well to receive almost $1 million in additional funding for our Beyond the Yellow Ribbon program, which provides additional layers of resources well past the normal post-deployment timeline for service members in Oregon. The next priority for OMD is emergency preparedness, as we've discussed. Timely to this conversation, September is declared Preparedness Month by Governor Brown. It is especially important for all of us to prepare our families to be self-sufficient during a major disaster. OEM has developed significant outreach efforts to promote the governor's declaration, as we've previously discussed, and we advocate and continue to advocate at least 2 weeks of limited to no outside support. The Cascadia subduction zone were to see a full rupture. The first few days of our response will really come down to citizen helping citizen, and we need to make sure we are taking care of our families first so we can then provide support to our neighbors, communities, and fellow Oregonians. Lastly, in line with Governor Brown's objectives, we need to be effective stewards of our state and federal resources. For OMD, one of the more visible areas in that regard is with the lead abatement and conversion of our armory indoor firing ranges. In March 2014, 12 active indoor firing ranges were closed and sealed, and a series of tests and cleanups followed. State funding was provided to tackle lead cleanup at our Forest Grove and Roseburg armories. One of my top priorities in the 17 and 19 agency request budget is a lead abatement policy package seeking $10.8 million in general fund to be matched with an equal amount of federal funding that will rectify this problem. These funds are necessary to provide safe environments for not just OMD employees, but all the users of our facilities. In closing, I want to thank you for the opportunity to share my vision of my organization with you, your continued support to our citizen soldiers, airmen, and all of OMD. It's absolutely critical to the success of our organization, not just on the state level, but the national level as well. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, General. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. General, can you explain a little better on the change of mission for an armory? And I think the Dalles just recently went under a change. I don't know what's involved or why that happens. And then to follow that up from a practical standpoint, what happens to the soldiers that had been assigned to that armory if their MOS doesn't change? Do right. they then get assigned somewhere else? How does that work logistically?
Chair Lively, Representative Huffman, ideally, they will be reassigned, and it will be at the next closest available type of armory. Some of these were to realign missions and make them more convenient within the I-5 corridor where the headquarters are. I know at the Dalles we've moved some folks from Milton Freewater on the military police side that will now be going and drilling there. But it's just for a more efficient realignment within those organizations.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? I just might make a comment. The timing of having your report and the previous report is interesting only from the fact that it just reinforces this how we prepare and the other issues that you face from the National Guard standpoint. I mean, if we think about the role of the National Guard now in world events, which is so much more when we'll have soldiers that aren't here locally to respond, that just makes the efforts we do locally to prepare that much more critical that we do. So this was a good time to cover all of that to help reinforce the challenge that we all face in preparing the challenges that you certainly in the National Guard face with the changing mission and the requirements for upgrades and things. But so thank you very much.
That was my pleasure.
Sure. Anyone else? Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you for your time.
You bet. Thank you. Okay, next we have the Task Force on Incarcerated Veterans, House Bill 2838. Representative Evans, are you going to
join us on the Task Force?
I'm going to try to keep you from going.
What are you going to try to do?
Mr. Task Force is up.
You don't have to take that ball.
The representative formerly known as Mr. Task Force.
Mr. Task Force, now Representative Evans.
Now known as Representative Evans, yes. Okay.
No respect. No.
You ready?
Go for it.
Hope she is, huh? Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Lively, members of the committee, I am Paul Evans. I formally represent House District 20, which includes parts of Monmouth, Independence, West Salem, and South Salem, but hopefully affectionately known as the representative from the Task Force District. Today, I'm here to begin a conversation on a task force that was quite frankly
a very, very effective use of time, energy, and I think you're going to be pleased with the results. Unfortunately, I need to leave relatively briefly after I speak. I know that's disheartening for Representative Huffman, but there's actually a building celebration, ribbon cutting over in Western Oregon that I will be leaving a little bit at. So I will start it off, and then the person that actually knows the information will take over, Heidi, and you'll be very pleased with that. My opening comments were really pretty much kind of the how we got here and what's going on. House Bill 2838, as you know, started out as a plan to try and justify increases in outreach and personnel for folks that are incarcerated that happen to have been veterans. After a discussion about how we get from here to there, it was recognized that a plan and an understanding of the work ahead would be a reasonable first step. And I want to emphasize why we even tried to do that. In 2008, when Governor Kongoski had his Task Force on Veteran Services, it was recognized that there was a surprising and disturbing increase among incarcerated folks that were veterans. And as that, unfortunately, we have continued to be at war. We've continued to experience that that growth. It was identified that something could be done. So we had a lot of questions, and sometimes these questions led to other questions, which was actually kind of fun in the process. How many veterans are in the system? Well, we have an interesting requirement in the state of Oregon that certain information we're not actually allowed to share with the, with ourselves, which is interesting. Hopefully someday we'll be able to work on that. But in the meantime, trying to recognize the most effective way of DOC and ODVA and other entities communicating, making sure that vets in the system understand what the rights and opportunities and benefits they may still be eligible for in the system, that we wanted to know what type of transitional opportunities were available for release. We wanted to know what other states were doing so we didn't have to reinvent the wheel. And ultimately, we wanted to not only find a way to help people, but do it in a way that was responsible, because we are, in fact, stewards of a limited amount of money. So the task force really focused, in terms of scope, on outreach. It focused on what assistance is available in terms of applying for benefits and aid, assistance in appealing benefits, aid denials, informational materials, and the other things that are listed on the slides before you. Some of the things I want to emphasize, though, sometimes task forces wait and then provide recommendations, and then we move forward. But the folks at the Department of Corrections and the folks at Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs are so hard working and trying to meet the mission that we actually started to do some things that made sense while we were going. So today we can actually tell you point blank that the pilot projects you see up above you are already ongoing. First, the goals of intake is to make sure that we, number one, verify veterans' status. Why that's important, by the way, in case people aren't necessarily aware of this, once the federal government finds out a veteran is incarcerated, if they are receiving benefits, they don't necessarily know the first day that they go in, but at some point they will take the money back that's been awarded inappropriately, and that can sometimes be not only a surprise but a problem for folks trying to navigate post-release. The other thing is that some folks are still entitled to certain kinds of care while in, and that if we can identify those folks, we might actually be able to optimize funds, thereby making other state services more accessible. So at intake, verifying who is and who isn't a veteran, one of the most important things. Sounds simple, but a little harder to do than we anticipated. Assisting veterans in the management of their VA disability and pension claims, providing information on educational opportunities. Some veterans may, in fact, still be eligible for the GI Bill while they're in, so that they can actually prepare for their career post-release. We also had discussions on an actual process, and in fact, ODVA and DOC came to an agreement on how to make it work, and we have the pilot program working as of today.
That's right.
So I know that there'll be more coming on that particular effort. Veterans Reentry Search Service. release of information form inside the Department of Corrections in partnership with the federal VA, trying to pilot a program requesting inmates to fill out a release information that allows for sharing of information among folks trying to make sure that they're taken care of. Again, it's a legalistic kind of thing, but it's necessary because without that, we can't actually share information that you would think we'd be able to. Third, something that we knew about going in, but we didn't necessarily know the size and scale of, the impact of women veterans in the system. Not just numbers, but the particular types of care that may be more appropriate and things that we hadn't thought of previously. Process is being explored to determine the number of women veterans incarcerated at Coffee Creek. Data will be collected voluntarily. Individuals interested in participating in the identification exercise will have their information run through the VRSS system to confirm their veterans status. Veterans benefits. We're also, I want to take this moment to just praise ODVA and DOC's coordination on this one and to recognize the efforts of ODVA to begin a conversation with the federal VA so that in Oregon, perhaps not everywhere, but certainly in Oregon, what used to take 9 months or more for people to get their benefits back after they've been released, there is now an agreement, a formal agreement in place that will be ensuring that if there's no appeal, no adjustment, no other request. So basically, if the veteran is trying to get reinstatement of the percentage that they had at the time they went in, it'll be kicked in within 30 days or less of their release. Why is that important? Well, for folks trying to get their life back together that have earned benefits, that can be a tremendous opportunity and a tremendous impact. So that's already going on. And I believe their goal is to get it down to 4 working days. But we're going to say 30 days and then just overperform. ODVA Veteran Service Officer will do interviews through, again, the self-identification process at the intake center. And during the intake, we already talked about that. Telehealth and telejustice. Technology, though scary to me and many others, can actually help in this particular case. For appeals, for delivery of certain types of care, for coordination of post-release efforts. Establishment of a federal VA telehealth portal in the Department of Corrections will allow veterans to have the appeal and pre-hearing meetings through a telejustice program. You ask yourself, why is that important? Well, appeals, the process by which somebody introduces information for a reconsideration of a claim, can take years and years and years. So for folks that are in the system for years and years, why not take advantage of that? And again, I want to applaud folks for working on the technical aspects to be able to make that a possibility. In conclusion, before I hand it off to Heidi, I want to say the following. Around the state of Oregon, sometimes we don't recognize or identify how hard agencies try to do things, how hard the folks inside the agencies actually try to make things work within the letter of the law. This task force, more than any other process that I've been involved in the last 10, 15 years, showcased the willingness, and again, the pilot projects are proof of that, not just to meet the intent of the task force or trying to find the recommendations, but in fact, a level of creativity and innovation that really we had no right to expect given all the other things they had to do. So I want to hand it off to Heidi to explain the facts and details and follow through, but as far as the support for a task force to find relevant information and at the same time begin to improve the lives of veterans that happen to be incarcerated and their families, it's already begun. And this has been just a meaningful process. I'm going to shut up and hand it off to Heidi.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Before the representative slips away, I feel compelled to say on the record that thank you for the work. And the report and the work is impressive enough that I am tempted, I'm considering not teasing you about task forces again. I'm considering because this is good work.
Right now.
That's okay. Right.
Okay.
We need to vote on that.
I could be talked out.
Thank you.
Get carried away.
Hold on.
Representative Parrish, please.
I won't cross that line. We'll still call him from the task force district. But I do have an actual real question. On the telehealth, teleconnect side or whatever that fourth bullet was, you know, one of the things that I have heard, and I, you know, get out to Coffee Creek, is, you know, the ability to all of this stuff, the VA is all online. So are we giving them, as part of the pilots, we're going to give them access to a computer and the internet and be able to actually
Controlled access, I believe, would be the... But she actually has a lot of detail on this.
Because I've heard stories, I mean, from other prisons where people are filling this stuff out by hand and trying to reach VAs. You know, we can't make people do that.
I think you're going to be very pleased with where it's going.
Okay, thank you. And thank you for the work on this. It's a near and dear, so...
Thank you. Very good.
Thank you.
I'll stay in as long as I have to.
Okay, great. I'll try to fly through this as quickly as I can. So good afternoon, Chair Lively, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Heidi Stewart, and I'm the Assistant Director of the Offender Management and Rehabilitation Division with the Oregon Department of Corrections. And I had the privilege to serve as chair for the Task Force on Incarcerated Veterans. And I'm here today to provide an overview on the task force report. We estimate to have approximately 1,250 incarcerated veterans within our prison systems, which is about 8.5% of our overall prison population. It's important to note that veteran status is a lifetime designation, and just because somebody is incarcerated or has been incarcerated does not terminate their veteran's eligibility for benefits. So upon release, a veteran is entitled to all earned benefits. This is the faster the benefits are provided to the veteran after release, the greater the chances of success when the veteran returns to the community. So through the course of its work, the task force found there wasn't accurate data on incarcerated veterans, as Representative Evans explained to you. So we estimate 1,250, and we got that number because 8.1% of Oregonians are veterans, and then we look towards our neighbors to the north, the Washington State Department of Corrections, and they have a very robust system in place for verifying veteran status, and they're very similar in population to the Oregon Department of Corrections, and their overall percentage of veterans within their system is 8.5%, so we thought that was a pretty safe percentage to go with, and that's how we got to the 1,250. The reason why our numbers are not accurate is because currently we have a self-report system. So somebody comes to the Department of Corrections through our intake process. They're given a questionnaire with a variety of questions on there, and one is, are you a veteran? And they check yes or no. And so what we found is many people who aren't veterans are checking the yes box, and then many people who are veterans are not checking the box. So, currently, we've actually just implemented, Rep. Evans talked about the pilot at intake. We just started a process where we can verify veteran status, and in the past we haven't been able to do that. So that's why our numbers are quite inaccurate at this time. The task force also found many of our incarcerated veterans are unaware of how to apply for benefits. They're unaware of the importance of notifying the federal VA immediately upon their incarceration, so their benefits are suspended or reduced in order to prevent having to repay potentially tens of thousands of dollars in overpayments upon release. And they're not aware of how to restart their benefits upon release. For many incarcerated veterans who are receiving disability compensation, all are part of the compensation while incarcerated may be apportioned to a veteran spouse, to their children, or to dependent parents on the basis of individual need. And again, many of our incarcerated veterans don't know this. So based on these findings, the task force developed a set of recommendations. First set of recommendations is around collecting accurate data. So we've talked a lot about that. Identifying veterans at intake is obviously essential to being able to provide them with the information that they need in order to manage their benefits. And collecting data on veterans is critical to developing and implementing appropriate policies and programs. So the task force recommends that the Department of Corrections and Department of Veterans Affairs develop systems to, one, accurately identify who our veterans are, and two, gather, maintain, and share data on incarcerated veterans, including number of veterans, benefits claims, and veteran services provided. And then the outreach. It's critical that veterans receive counseling on how to manage their federal VA disability and pension claims so they are not burdened with the reduced disability compensation, terminated pension benefits, and repaying overpayments upon their release from prison. So the task force recommends that the Department of Corrections and the Veterans Affairs establish a formalized process to counsel veterans on how to manage their federal VA disability and pension claims, their benefits adjustments, and apportionments, provide information and advocacy to veterans on benefits they have earned, and notify the federal VA that a veteran is incarcerated to eliminate the potential of overpayments. And then reentry services. Reinstating or connecting veterans to benefits and services so benefits are, and services are available upon release is obviously critical to the veteran's success upon reentry. So the task force recommends that the Department of Corrections and Department of Veterans Affairs establishes a coordinated and formalized reentry program that includes reinstating benefits, connecting veterans to a county veteran service officer post-release, train corrections release staff on veteran-specific benefits, and facilitate the transition to federal VA health care. However, in order to fully implement the recommendations of the task force and operationalize the pilot projects, adequate staffing is necessary. This is a lot of additional work one-on-one with our veterans and counseling.
If I could add here, it is understood and assumed that this would be coming out of a successful ballot measure 96. And I want to emphasize that the things already going on are already going on, and that the Department of Corrections was very, very conservative in terms of the costs, trying to be good stewards. Mm-hmm. And the numbers you see right now are what we need. Now, this is not the Cadillac version. This is the Chevy version. But it's a Chevy version that should get the job done.
Mr. Parrish, I guess you have a question.
We're all about lots of forms of transit. Do we have a bike version? I'm the ODOC 6 trained and accredited benefit coordinators. Mm-hmm. Are you anticipating that those are going to be like employees of the Department of Corrections, or is there a way to do the model where it's like veterans helping veterans and we accreditate them, which is what's happening in other states, is that they're getting the training to be. And then I don't know if you've paid those folks to their, you know, prison books or whatever, but you know, but that we task and train, you know, people who are inside the walls to do the work and not have a, you know, new corrections FTE.
Right. Chair Lively, Representative Parrish, these are Department of Corrections staff that would be trained through ODVA. They would go through their intensive six-month training process. They would have access to their system online and would be able to enter all of the information into the ODVA system.
And new FTE?
It would be new FTE.
This package, again, the idea was to come up with what could actually do what Washington does at about a third the cost. Washington has a very robust program. To answer your question on this particular piece, the six DOC employees would be the barest bones staffing we could do, but the idea would be that they would also be training helpers to do some of what you're hearing about in other places. There's 14 facilities in the state of Oregon. And it was discussed whether we had a long conversation about whether it would make sense to have them be ODVA folks, maybe county VSOs that go to different places, this and the other thing. But for flexibility and, quite frankly, the most economic model would be using DOC staff that have that specialty and, again, to help support, in certain cases, veterans helping other veterans with the information. But they would be trained by ODVA, certified by ODVA, so that they could do those tasks.
Would you like to follow up?
I would like to follow up.
I thought you might.
So let's say we, you know, kind of do this for, say, you know, 2 years, bust through the 1,250 people. There's ongoing where you're going to have new people in. But once you get through the big chunk, then the need for that much FTE reduces. So how do you then say to those folks, well, you know, we sort of don't need six at this point. Maybe we need two. And is there a plan for how you would reduce that level of staff going forward so that we could free up those Measure 96 dollars again for other stuff?
That's why we went with DOC staff, because I assume there's other tasks that they could be doing inside the system.
There are, but I'd like to explain more of the role of these individuals, because it isn't just that they're going to work with them at intake and then they're going to work with them at release. So they're going to be working with these veterans during the entire time that they're with us. And their responsibilities include signing them up for benefits outside of VA benefits, so Medicaid, Medicare, and other federal and state benefits. They would be very involved with release planning, so they'd need to network with all 36 counties and veteran service providers in those counties so that they can help, they can develop solid release plans upon release. So it's not just a matter of helping them with their benefits and entering the information into a system. It's an ongoing one-on-one counseling, working with families, coordinating veterans' activities within the institution, and so on.
Okay, follow up one more.
Sure.
So and I love the model. We have, I wanted 5% for Measure 96. We're going to have like $19 million. It's a small population of veterans compared to what's outside the walls. And I want to be cautious about how we would move forward and implement a plan that benefits 1,250 people and there's still 330,000 people outside.
I'll take a shot and then Heidi can actually make it more accurate. Number one, the 1,200 people will also at some point go through the parole process, go into reentry, go into other things. So these experts will actually be assisting county level as well as the what you're thinking of in terms of the state system. We anticipate that there will be a continuing flow of incarcerated veterans. And quite frankly, I wanted 12 rather than 6. And this was the barest model because in many ways, veteran peace aside, a lot of those services are going on or need to go on for reentry anyway. This is truly the Chevy model. So
be cautious about locking down a bunch of money into FTE for agencies when our goal is to also get the stuff boots on the ground into nonprofits.
Equally defensive of the Measure 96 dollars given the financial environment. That said, this is truly the Chevy model. I had a bigger idea.
Can I have one more follow-up? On your six trained and accredited reentry, so like I've been into the Department of Corrections to do volunteer work. Theoretically, could this be tasked to some of the nonprofit VSO, which the measure allows for, and they can come in, do some of that work, but then go back out into the field for other veterans? I mean, I'm trying to like wrap my head around how it's a full-time, everyday job for 1,200 people. I mean, if we could maybe think about creatively how we could use VSO,
Chair Lively, Representative
and let
Parrish.
Them have entry into inside to do
Yeah, we absolutely can look at other models to utilize. Part of the reason why we have 14 institutions located across the state, so there's a lot of travel involved to get to the east side of the state where some of our largest institutions are, so that had to be factored into the number of FTE that we were asking for. But absolutely, we can look at other models and determine what that would look like. The scope then of what would be offered would probably shrink just because they wouldn't be coordinating veteran activities necessarily within the institutions. They probably wouldn't be able to coordinate with the federal VA when they came in for the telehealth or for their medical screenings and so on and so forth. So
the other part
it would
just
look different.
There are federal guidelines and requirements that make it harder than I thought it would be for some of the traditional organizations to just walk in and do those things. So the six employees were the strategy was to make sure that there was sufficient folks to be able to go throughout the system, meet the requirements, and actually have an impact. That said, it is a recommendation.
Okay.
Thank you. I apologize.
So
I do have to.
No problem. Park. I think we have one final slide. And it's just in closing. Together, these recommendations create a coordinated and formalized veterans program intended to provide a seamless transition from incarceration out into the community. A formal program for incarcerated veterans is in the best interest not only of the veteran but of the state of Oregon. If a veteran receives federal benefits, including disability compensation, health care, educational or job training immediately upon release, then the veteran has a greater likelihood of success in the community. The veteran's risk to recidivate decreases, and the potential cost to the state for expensive safety net services, including housing, health care, and living expenses, is also reduced. And so that concludes my portion of
the
presentation.
Do you
have any
questions for Heidi? Thank you for all your work on this and for
Absolutely.
The recommendations. We look forward to hearing as things move forward. Hopefully we have the money in which to implement
at least
how the program works.
Yeah.
Yes. Thanks a lot, Heidi.
Yes, thank you very much.
Sure. Okay, so next up we're going to have a conversation regarding State Interoperability Executive Council. I know Representative Parrish is familiar with this. I've recently joined, and as I was sitting there listening to their conversations, that I thought there's a real link here between what they're doing in this resiliency and emergency response net, and I'm not sure how much everybody here knows about it, but I thought it'd be good for the committee anyway to hear kind of an update.
Our real expert. I know some. He's our real expert down there.
Okay. I learned more than I wanted to.
Well, we're going to get an update today from David. Thank you for being here, David.
Thank you, Chair Lively and the committee for having us here to give you an opportunity to explain kind of what we've been doing and what we're going to try to do in the next biennium. My name is David Solis. I'm the State Wireless Interoperability Coordinator. I'm sort of a one-man band with my program, one FTE and a little bit extra from ODOT help and some in my own staff that are grant-funded from a federal grant. We work closely with emergency management and others, which I'll get into in a moment. I kind of want to just give you an overview of who we are and then talk about the two big bodies of work that we work on, which is mission critical or public safety voice communications and then mission critical or public safety data communications, and then kind of wrap that up. My program and office is in the office of the state CIO, Alex Pettit. In 2001, as we all remember tragically, the 9/11 event happened, and after that, we realized there were a lot of issues as a country with interoperability, which is generally the ability of one set of public safety first responders to talk to another that isn't them, commonly known as can police talk to fire, is what we sort of say in the vernacular. And the answer is sometimes yes and a lot of times no. And that's still true today. So moving forward, with that, there were two buckets of things that happened. There was a lot of impetus to develop a federal wireless data network, which we do not have now. Our first responders use data plans on their phones and devices, just kind of like we do. And we've all been aware in Sandy and Rita and so forth that when those cell towers get overloaded or downed in an event, well, then the communications, the data communications of our first responders goes down too. So that's the data side. And along with that, our governor, the federal government had a statute or a rule, a law that said that every state had to have a SWIC, State Wireless Interoperability Coordinator, in order to receive Homeland Security funding. So no surprise, every state went out and created these positions, and Oregon's is in ORS 403, and I am it. So, and that's on the voice side. And so during the 2000s, there was a lot of federal grant money that flowed. And so a lot of, just significant billions, spread out across the 56 states and territories. And in a nutshell, that money is generally no longer there for us. So to the voice communications, the State Interoperability Executive Council, again created by statute, is a council of, 22 members, 10 of them are basically state agency heads. Andrew Phelps and David are on it, and several others from other emergency and agencies in the state. The local first responders are the other 10, and then one representative, Chair Lively, is on it, and Senator Johnson is from the Senate side on the committee. We meet quarterly and go through, no surprise, interoperability issues and what's happening, and there's no lack of them. For further context, as you probably know better than I, Oregon is about 98,000 square miles. According to Homeland Security, we have about 530 primary first responder agencies. In addition, there's probably another 300 secondary first responder agencies, emergency management groups, transportation, utilities, public and private, and so forth. In addition, then we have a study going now to inventory all of the public safety radio systems in Oregon, kind of defined at the lowest common denominator of who has spectrum licenses from the FCC in the public safety spectrum ranges to operate public safety radios. And there were, as of yesterday morning at 8 o'clock, 642. So we have 530 public first responders operating. They're not individual. Several of them operate more than one radio system, but that's a lot of radio systems, conventional, digital, trunked, non-trunked, and all these other words. I want to have all that interoperate is our committee's task and my task as the coordinator. And so we have small systems that are going to be one base station, and one antenna or two antennas and a couple of radios and a couple of, law enforcement vehicles to a system the size of the city of Portland's, which is huge. and they've got, I don't know, 12,000 subscriber units on that system and everything in between. And our job is to, again, work so that all the police and fire and EMS primarily and the secondaries can speak with one another. So the committee has an executive committee, and it has four operating and working committees. It's got a partnership committee. It has a strategic planning committee. There's a technical committee and a broadband or a FirstNet committee. Again, that's the wireless data network primarily. So we work on a lot of other things. Last year, we had a little bit of extra money left over from some work that ODOT did with the radio system, and we used some of that money to host the first, what we call, radio conference. We've had a lot of conferences where the administrators and the policy folks meet, but we hadn't had a conference before of the actual owners and operators, the people that really sit down and go back into the data rooms and program the radios and so forth. And we were expecting about 40 or 45 people statewide, and we had about 80 or 85. So we're doing that again next year, and we want to annualize that because it was very valuable. Coming from that, we just that conversation, they had identified an issue with the use of national interoperability frequencies. And so we have just concluded a study with the help of Department of Homeland Security on that. The ink's not yet dry. I just sent it out today to all the technical folks to take a look and then get a briefing from Homeland Security on kind of what does this mean for Oregon. And at our border, what does it also mean for, say, Clark County and Benton County, Washington, because there's a lot of border coordination that's required because the frequencies don't know any border boundaries. The Department of Homeland Security, outside of the minimal assessment for my FTE, is our source of some extra funding to do some work. And they allow each state each year to have five what they call technical assistance requests. And those tend to follow what the federal government, needless to say, would like to see in state interoperability. So we can have these technical assistance requests cover governance, technology, usage, and so forth. And the ones we've recently done are actually countywide assessments, and they tend to come back and say the same thing, which is in Oregon they would like to see more governance. In the statute that creates the SIEC and the SWCC position, the authority really is more of a carrot authority: recommend, coordinate, help, assist, identify, as opposed to stick authority, which is fine, but it does mean that over and over and over again we have these sort of almost similar, almost identical county by county statewide assessment reports of all of the radio systems that are in these counties. We've also done, with these technical assistance requests from Homeland Security, we've done a lot of mobile data surveys, and that's, again, getting ready for this federal wireless data network, and we're conducting another one right now, and it'll be kind of nice because we did one in 2012, we did one in 2015, and so we can have some, if not a longitudinal study of them, we can have, you know, 100 or 110 or so agencies every 3 years identify their wireless data usage, and we can break that down to law enforcement and fire and EMS again, and we can see both agency by agency as well as general trends of what is the mobile wireless data usage in Oregon, and then work with what resources we have to help be more efficient in their use of mobile data and the onset of FirstNet. We're also allowed to do some trainings, and as you may have heard, you know, in our large incidents, like, and in Cascadia was, of course, the poster child, there are a lot of well-trained people in these communications positions, and a lot of other for Cascadia, but my focus is on the communications component. And we call them COMELs and COMTs. They're communications unit leaders and communications technicians. And so they will set up at an incident command, and we do this every year with our forest fires because we've been doing it for years. You know, they'll set up this mobile command center, mobile IMTs, they call it, and the communications will be coordinated out of that. In addition, we have a tactical interoperable field guide. I'm trying hard to stay away from the acronyms because we just live them. So we do call it a tick fog, I have to say that. But it is this guide. We have it in hard copy. It's downloadable. It's also an app. And so every first responder in Oregon can download this, and he or she will have this so that as they travel across their radio boundary, do mutual aid or help somebody else or some large event or a Cascadia, they will know. And it basically tells you when you go into this area, switch to channel 3 for tactical law enforcement, switch to channel 4 or something like that. You know, they have these names and nicknames and for these various channels. And so this is a significant undertaking, and we need to update this every year. We don't really have the resources to do it, so we're doing it every other year. And again, with the ODOT, a little bit of extra money from ODOT with the interoperability, we're undertaking this right now. And so we work with all of our regional coordinators, and then they go down to their local radio operators, and then everybody kind of edits this, and it comes back up. And then we have to pick a date where we freeze it because we need to make an app out of it. And one of the things we're doing is we're continuing to make it more functional on the apps as we hear from the users. So that's another piece of work that we do that helps our first responders. We're required by statute and by the federal government to have a state communications interoperability plan. And again, when I say state, it's not just state of Oregon, but statewide, so it includes our local first responders, and we just finished putting this year's together, and we just signed it, and there's basically five components that are required, again, by the federal government, and we have a couple of our own. So the five required are governance, standard operating procedures, technology, training and exercises, and usage, and Oregon has added outreach and information sharing, and financing or sustainability, which is difficult. As you can imagine, these systems are expensive. They're not your ordinary, already expensive network, best efforts network, as they call it. These are what we target at what we call 99.99% of reliability for first responders, meaning it's available 99.999% of the time. If you figure out how many minutes are in a year, that comes down to a hair over 5 minutes a year that these need to go down, which is what, because we rely on them. You can't call 911 or have 911 call dispatch or dispatch try to get a hold of a vehicle and it doesn't work. And so that getting from that best efforts level network, which is already expensive, to a 99.999% level is why these systems are so expensive. And to put that in context, as you're probably aware, Washington and Clackamas counties just recently passed bond measures. One of them was, I believe, $60-65 million, the other $75-80 million for major upgrades. These aren't even like brand new systems, major upgrade of the current system. So those are some of the things we work on. We do have, in addition, as we can, again, with some of the leftover money from ODOT, we ran an interoperability grant program this year. And so we advertised that out and ran a process, and we had about $1.6 or $8 million available. We were able to award 4 grants initially, and then we ran a fifth, another sort of a subset, because there was still some revenue or some funding left. And so we ended up with 5 of those, and those all need to be actually complete, not just started, but complete by the spring of 17. So forgive me, but I see you smiling.
I'm bothering him, Mr. Chair.
Did you apply for a grant? And
can I jump in?
Yes, you can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, after several mentions, how much money did Mr. Lauer have left on the state radio project?
Well, I think you'd need to ask Mr. Lauer that.
Because Mr. Lauer never got back with me and said, oh, by the way, Rep. Huffman, we had some money left. I'm just...
Well, I'm relatively new to this position, and so I really don't want to speak for him, but I believe that basically that surplus interoperability fund was in total $2.3 million. And we've used that to do interoperability, like update our SCIP, our State Communications Interoperability Plan.
Budget dust compared to what we spent.
Correct. But it's never budget dust if you don't have it, right?
So. Follow up. Actually, on a different track, I think the feds were talking D-block spectrum stuff, trying to dedicate it for this national interoperability effort. And I don't care what it's called, but I think that's what Greg Walden and others I heard talk about. But is that ever going to happen? Because I've heard it talked about for a number of years. Is it going to happen? Are the feds going to pay for it, or are we going to have to pick up a lot of the bill, which kind of smarts after, you know, spending quite a bit on the state radio project to do some interoperability, quite a bit. Can you spend just a little more time on that?
Chair Lively, Representative Huffman, members of the committee. Yes, I'll just use that as my segue from voice mission critical voice communications to the federal wireless data project, which we commonly know as FirstNet, which is the 20 megahertz block and the 700 megahertz spectrum that you're referring to. And that started getting funded at the state level with the passage in 2012 of the Middle Class Tax Relief Act. It was a rider or an addition in there. And Congress allocated funding to every state based on a combination of its physical size and its population to do outreach and education for phase one, which we completed. And then for phase two was to do a significant amount of data gathering, which we did. They initially came through and said the coverage objectives for the state of Oregon are this, and it basically equated to about 25% of the geographic area of Oregon, which generally was, as your mind's eye will tell you, is the population centers and the primary transportation corridors.
Kind of follows the decision we had to make on state radio, because you just can't afford to cover
everything.
I just want to emphasize that FirstNet is data network, and the state radio is Mission Critical Voice Network. So they are very different. And at this time in the planning for FirstNet, there will not be Mission Critical Voice over that network. So we will still, us and our local jurisdictions will still continue to need to fund and own and operate those Mission Critical Voice radio systems for at least probably 10 years to come. And maybe 15 and maybe 20. You can do voice over this spectrum, but it wouldn't be what they call mission critical voice communications. And so they will run in parallel. So that's another aspect of my work. And I have the grant that we have from the federal government staffs most of my position, and I have two staff. And we do a significant amount, again, of outreach and education, but also the data collection. So when we received the information from FirstNet on the coverage objectives for Oregon, we went out and collected primary data from about 55 of their sets of data and spent 6 or 7 months doing that and submitted that back to FirstNet. And it kind of flips what we hope to see, and we really kind of hope to see FirstNet with fixed coverage covering about 75% of Oregon, with 25% having mobile coverage. We don't know yet. FirstNet is run out of the U.S. Department of Commerce. They have an RFP on the street for a partner to build the network. They're not allowed to say even who applied. What we know, the companies who said they applied was AT&T, a consortium that skips my mind, and another company called Rivada. Whether they actually did or not, we don't know. The short of it is that FirstNet is supposed to award that contract or make the decision on the vendor and have the contract signed by November. So that would be, you know, in 8 weeks or so, 12 weeks, very, very shortly. At that point, we hope to be, as a state, to beginning to sit down with the vendor for its state plan people and nailing down a state plan for Oregon. There's another option with FirstNet that you may not have heard of, and that is that the statute does give states the option to say, thank you very much for offering to build FirstNet. We're going to build it ourselves. That's what they call opt-out. But the state would have to identify funding, apply for the grants, hope for revenue from subscribers, from a portion, whatever portion of the federal money that was going to be used to build the network initially.
And we're not looking at going that route, right?
No one is looking at that route. And there's a chain of recommendation into this, what we call opt-in, opt-out. It's for me as the state SWIC to recommend to the FirstNet committee of the SIEC, to recommend to the full committee, to recommend to state CIO Alex Pettit, who recommends into the governor's office. And we've already had preliminary meetings, and people were like, you know, let's not have this conversation. The federal government can do this. The vendors who are going to be wireless carriers know how to build, manage, own, and operate wireless networks. It's not our core. Let's let them do that, and let's help. Our primary focus in this whole thing is to expand greater coverage of the fixed network in Oregon beyond what our first responders can get from current cellular coverage today. That's our big goal.
You did bring up another point, ongoing maintenance of effort. Who's going to be responsible? If we agree and the federal government comes in, pays to have the system built out, do we then take responsibility and have ongoing maintenance responsibilities?
Chair Lively, Representative Huffman, committee. That is a great question, and one of the advantages of allowing the federal government and its FirstNet partner to come in is they will be doing all of that, and we will be more in the role of a subscriber. But I do want to address your question of ongoing role for the state beyond just being a subscriber to help with interoperability and everything else we're going to need to do as a state to make FirstNet the best that it can be for our first responders in Oregon. And I hate to say it, but the answer is I don't know yet. If FirstNet, say, picks vendor A, they're going to have one existing infrastructure footprint in Oregon, and it's going to go one way. And if they pick carrier B, say, it could be different. And so we don't know yet, but we're anticipating a significant role for the state in this coordination role, as you're suggesting, going forward. And we've been working with a lot of other states to try to develop kind of an outline of what that would look like for all states so that we don't have 56 states and territories second-guessing FirstNet about what their support might be. And we're trying to get FirstNet to let us know, at least in an outline, so that we're all coordinated better as we proceed. The timeline for FirstNet is, again, they're hoping to select the vendor in November. And then the environmental impact statement is also going to be released actually next month, and then it has to go through its decision. So that hopefully will be behind us. Then next, say, summer, fall, they will be presenting drafts of every state and territory's plan to its SIEC or equivalent, where we review it for 60 days. And then it's driven by statute at this point. When they provide the formal state plan for FirstNet, the states have up to 90 days to essentially opt out and say we're going to build it ourselves. If a state says we're going to work with you and let you or allow you to build it or does nothing, then the federal government and FirstNet come in and build that the network in that state.
Another question. So if I can get a visual on this, would PSAPs receive data receivers then? Where would the information be channeled through to get to our first response? We use PSAPs, 911 centers, you know, as kind of the dispatch.
Chair Lively, Representative Huffman, members of the committee, that's the $64,000 question. There is not money directly in FirstNet in building this network to upgrade the PSAPs to follow. We have 7 or 8 PSAPs from North Marion to Portland to Astoria, I believe, right now that have gone to text to 911, which is data. Mm-hmm. It's not video, it's not pictures, but it's data. So we're kind of getting there, and that is a big question. The 911 industry folks, we call them APCO NENA, it's their trade name, have a role on the SIEC. Its Oregon chapter chair is the president or the chair of the SIEC Strategic Partnership Committee. He and they are very involved in this question, both in Oregon and nationally, about, okay, we open up these PSAPs to all this data. How are they going to get it through to the first responders? Do the first responders want the wave of all the data? Who edits it? Who filters? And then we're into the typical questions that we have today with body cams and car cams, which is this huge storage cost in question because these are all public records. And that door is open. We know it's there. There's not direct funding in the FirstNet budget to upgrade our PSAPs. So the data at this point that we're talking about is data from responder to responder. And so building plans, and as the medical community uses it, it would be, you know, MRIs and who knows what. Some of the long-term forecasts is actually the heavy user of this network is going to be the medical community. Hmm. So the target for that, again, is adoption, the state plan by next fall, formally here, presumably adopted, and then we would opt in later and begin to work with FirstNet and its vendor immediately to help implement this and get it rolling in Oregon. So it would follow. Excuse me.
So, do you have representation from the Oregon hospital and health systems? Yeah, you mentioned that medical is going to be a big user probably in it. Who's representing that community? Do you know?
Chair Lively, Representative Huffman, members of the committee. Mike Harriman was the DHS OHA rep on the committee, but he just became the state resilience officer. And he has provided me the name of someone else in the organization that I need to contact, haven't yet, as this has happened in the last this week, to pull that person in as a member of the committee of the SIC. And as we know, statewide, a lot of our fire personnel are also EMS personnel in a lot of jurisdictions. And
are you fearful? I'm sorry. Thank you for the leniency, Mr. Chair. I'm kind of seeing, you know, the feds come in and build the backbone, and then we're probably going to be tasked with coming up with so many millions of dollars for the equipment so the backbone can actually be used. I mean, it's nice to have mountaintop repeaters and stuff that do this or that, but if you don't have the radios in the user's hands or in the PSAPs or wherever they're going to go, you just have a nice new tower up there. And
Chair Lively, Representative Huffman, members of the committee, that is true, except that FirstNet will be building the radio access network, all of it, and it will be a choice of first responders to become subscribers or not, just as today they have a choice of whether or not to become a wireless data or voice subscriber or not with our traditional commercial carriers. So FirstNet, to be just candid, will be competing for those public safety radio subscribers. And the state will sit in that position in terms of, say, the folks that OEM work with, state police, state fire marshal, and so forth. But we will also like to assist FirstNet and our first responders to make FirstNet the best network that it can be for our first responders to address some of those issues that you're talking about. And that might be more in terms of applications, deciding which users are in which, say, group. Cybersecurity is going to be a big issue. You've heard a lot about that this week, I believe. So we're in a little bit of a waiting game until FirstNet selects a vendor, and then we'll know who the vendor is, and we can begin having conversations about what their current network looks like, how their current network might interface with the FirstNet network, how our first responders will interface with them. But I believe to your question, the answer is the first responders will be then buying or subscribing units, handheld devices that are what we call band class 14, that are FirstNet ready. The manufacturing community is already building these devices.
So it's a technology, the proprietary part of it. It won't be locked into Motorola necessarily or a particular brand, but there could be multiple manufacturers. So we're not locked into a proprietary radio system per se. I mean, the backbone might be, but to link into it, not all sheriff's departments, all PSAPs, all fire departments are going to have one type of radio.
Chair Lively, Representative Huffman, members of the committee, that is my understanding. And that they're working, there's $500 million of the Congress put forward, developed a public safety research lab in Boulder, Colorado, right next to the School of Engineering at U of Colorado. And they work on these very issues and create standards so that the manufacturers can build these devices. And like I said, there are these devices available now. There are 5 first responder communities that were allowed to go forward with what we call early builder networks. They're all different. State of New Mexico, State of New Jersey, Harris County, Houston, Texas, Adams County, which is a suburban county northeast of Denver, and Los Angeles. And so there's a lot to be learned from this. They're already implemented. They're operating. They have folks who work with the people in Boulder. The people in Boulder come out and visit and work with them. It's a very, you know, we're all looking for the best solution and the best environment that we can. So, but again, I believe to answer your question, these will be more open standards. That might be too strong. Of standards that many, more than one manufacturer can build devices to operate on what we call band class 14, operate on FirstNet. And those are out there today and being operated today.
Those are all the kind of questions. I guess that's why we need to be having the conversations multiple times, because we may reach a point the way technology changes in that. I mean, the goal is wonderful, but we still may, we as a legislature and our partners amongst the state still may face, and especially once we talk about the voice side of it, because this is just the data side. Once we get to the point doing more from the voice side, those are all those kind of issues that we ought to be aware of as we go along, so we don't step into something and have to do it just because we haven't. It's interesting, you talked about we don't have, to some extent, we're not trying to force our local partners onto any system. We're trying to help them along from being able to communicate, especially across this. But at some point, goes back to what we've invested in the past, at some point, the state may have to take a more aggressive role in order to accomplish what we're trying to accomplish here, given the age of the equipment at the different places and all the those other issues and the changing technology. I don't know. It's way over my, it makes my head spin, but it goes back to, if we're going to survive an event, the system has to work. Mm-hmm. Isn't that the goal?
Chair Lively, members of the committee, that is correct. And what I'm sorry that I failed to say was that the other beauty of this spectrum is that it will be used commercially, but as an event comes on and as the first responders need it, they can exercise what they call priority and preemption, which basically either slowly or ruthlessly drops the commercial traffic off that 20 megahertz, and so the first responders can respond while you and I as citizens say our cell phones might not work, theirs will, and that's a huge benefit. And so you're absolutely right. We're trying to
represent Parrish.
Thank you. So our county just, I think, implemented the text to 911, which, you know, certainly lets people push into the law enforcement. Do we have the capability to go the other way? Like, so if there was an event, law enforcement can, you know, access carriers and text us.
Chair Lively, Representative Parrish, members of the committee, I believe they would do that. I'm not sure they would do that through the FirstNet network. They might do it to the ability that the commercial networks would allow. But that's a great question. But in terms of the law enforcement using FirstNet to go outside of FirstNet, my sense is I would doubt it, because it's primarily a network in these types of situations for first responders to communicate with first responders. If the network is not in an emergency state where it's prioritizing and kicking commercial traffic off, then we wouldn't know the difference. We would be getting texts or whatever if it's just routine.
Well, I guess follow up. So, you know, we get like a phone call, like an automated phone call from the police in the event that there's, you know, I mean, Westland does this where we, you know, there's a burglar in your neighborhood or whatever, please stay indoors right now. I mean, we've gotten those calls from law enforcement over our landline, but I guess I'm just curious if we have the ability and the capability. Most people are going away from a landline. Do we have that capability in our radio planning to be able to do that through cellular side?
Chair Lively, Representative Parrish, members of the committee, that I believe would still be there. These are moving into the emergency alert sides of the communications, which is the Office of Emergency Management's sort of paradigm.
But
this is because we can do it now, I'm sure we will still be able to do it. I think that the precise question is, can we do this over FirstNet? And that's a question I'll have to take back to see how they're planning the reverse of these alerts, if you will.
Yeah, thanks.
Other questions? Did you get most of it covered?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much, David. I'm sure we'll have more opportunities to keep updated, and especially once there's, I guess, the final steps in FirstNet and the plan for that.
Correct. And there's always more legislative days, and they'll be making this decision again. They're targeting November, and if they do, and we will know. But again, I wanted to thank you and the committee for having us and allowing us this opportunity. Thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for coming. Okay. So next, Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, Cameron Smith, Director. annual report. So now we get the good news to end on. Is that correct?
Good afternoon, Chair Lively, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And on this Friday afternoon, I only have about 36 slides. And do you have those, Cheyenne or Corey?
Yeah, who's got those slides?
I think they've been deleted by the staff.
It's not funny, huh?
Yeah, really.
But want to thank you for your engagement on a long day and a long week. And we are proud of our fiscal year 2016 annual report that we handed out to all the legislators this week. I am, for our Army chair, I am sad to say we do have a Marine on cover this year.
I noted that to my staff.
One of Uncle Sam's, fellow Uncle Sam's misguided children. And Mary Tanada served in 1964 to 1965, so an early leading woman serving in the Marines. Mm. Married her hometown sweetheart in Pendleton, also a Marine. He ended up getting deployed headed over to Vietnam. She found out she was pregnant, and the policy back then was discharge from the Marines for any pregnant women Marines, but on her 70th birthday, ended up getting her Semper Fi bulldog tattoo.
Great.
So
okay.
Once a Marine, always a Marine.
And
so it is fun. Our stories of our veterans, and we profile World War II to today in this, but also all of our results. $71 million in home loans, a record year for us going back over the last two decades.
That's right.
Now a $250 million portfolio that we are servicing. So thank goodness we've got a great team at ODVA, because I am not a banker capable of doing that. Our two skilled nursing facilities, we just celebrated today our second anniversary of Lebanon dedication, and literally at noon after the celebration, our 154th resident came in, World War II veteran, so we are effectively full at Lebanon, with, of course, transitions as folks go in and out. And effectively full in the Dalles. And one of the limiting factors for the Dalles is staffing. But out of Ways and Means this week, or Emergency Board this week, some federal VA grants that we will tap to be able to do some more nursing incentives, incentives to nursing staff to keep them working for us in the Dalles. On veteran services, that core bread and butter, from 2013 to today, we've doubled the number of new claims to over 12,000 now, drawing down $200 million extra per year. That is $400 million a biennium that is not falling onto the state general fund for safety net. But as we know, we can do a lot more for our veterans when we have 1,500 homeless across the state, when we're a quarter of all suicides, and even the 1,250 incarcerated that we estimate. And I would just hit quickly on our budget. We are an operational budget of $92.4 million for this current biennium. But what's surprising is 89% of that is generated off of the home loan mortgages payments by veterans and off of the two skilled nursing revenues. So about $10.1 million, 11% of our budget is that core bread and butter veteran services that does flow half down to the counties for that veteran service network. So where we see opportunities going forward in our agency request budget and as part of the governor's budget process, continue to invest in that veteran services system across the county and state, and also for aging veterans specifically with our some efforts that we have at the statewide level to try to end the subsidy of the home loan program revenue that helps shore up veteran services to the tune of $4 million a year. And then the broader partnerships that we know are delivering services to veterans outside of ODVA or the county VSOs, specifically around three priority areas of access to health and mental health, the homeless and housing crisis for veterans and their families, and then also better supporting student veterans on community colleges and university campuses. But happy to take any questions, if there are any.
Questions? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cameron, what was the deal that we were dealing with on the e-board this morning on the nursing situation? That didn't come to my subcommittee, so I didn't hear the full backstory, just kind of curious.
Chair Lively, Representative Huffman, has long been a challenge across the skilled nursing profession to be able to retain the number of CNAs, registered nurses, LPNs. It is a challenge across the entire healthcare space, even more of a challenge when you get to rural Oregon. The federal VA now has a grant program where they will match us dollar for dollar. So we have a $150,000 grant request At the end of this month, we will submit to the federal VA. We will match it with some of the revenues off of the veterans' homes. But three priority areas to better incent folks to come to us at the veterans' home in the Dalles and to stay with us on staff. From loan forgiveness when registered nurses are going back to school and then have a time phased in so you get them for at least a three-year chunk. The encouragement for CNAs to go back to school to keep going up the ladder. And then I'm forgetting our last third one. But essentially, we are trying to fill these shifts that are essential to provide the best in care. We are doing it out of existing staff and overtime and bonuses and trying to get to more of a sustainable, longer-term model because the nursing shortage is only going to get worse as more and more of all citizens age. Mm-hmm.
Follow-up?
Sure.
Is this largely targeted at two-year RNs in the RN spectrum, or is it two and BSN, four-year?
Chair Lively, Representative Huffman, I'm not sure, but we can follow up with you. I know it was kind of a three-year window on the loan forgiveness specifically.
Okay.
Other questions?
Just a comment. This is really nice. Very well done. This is a great piece of work. So thanks. Well, I know you didn't do it. But
and Representative Peluso, for as fancy as it is, all out of high. Other than the photographer that we get for very cheap to come to our Veterans Benefit Expos or the Women Veterans Conference. We just took over the Memorial Coliseum up in Portland at the beginning of September, captured a whole nother round of images, and looking to take that expo either to Southern Oregon or Central Oregon next year since we've done it in Salem and Portland for these first 2 years.
Nice. Thank you.
Representative Perry.
So I want to go back to the veterans' homes in Lebanon. You said is full basically now, and the one in the Dalles is probably pretty full. So I mean, what's it take to get another one of these built, and where would we site it?
So Chair Lively, Representative Parrish, already, I mean, it is statutory authority for the agency to move forward on a third veterans home. It is in statute going back to 2011 and has actually been identified by the legislature to be sited in Roseburg. There's a number of challenges, whether on the staffing side or the census side, to make sure that the pro formas would pencil out long term, given that this is all other fund revenue and we're not sinking limited general funds into providing the best in care. So there's the one side on just making sure both that we have the build out finances to construct it and the longer term operational revenue projected to be there for what we know is to be excellent care. But in terms of the build-out construction, we have a federal VA grant in for construction of that third veterans home. But more and more out of the federal VA construction budget, what we see them prioritizing is life safety and maintenance of existing facilities. Some of these veterans homes go back to Civil War era on the East Coast or in Minnesota, even on the bluffs of the Mississippi. So what we found was we've got that grant request in to get 65% of that. Historically, it's been a county bond, both out of Wasco County in the 90s, out of Linn County for the most recent one. As part of the original deal, there was some state funding that was associated with it when these statutes were first baked. So it would have to be a re-engagement of what is that local match. But we even, a later grant that we submitted for the Dalles on a life safety and maintenance one, that one rose in priority, has been approved, and we'll be starting a renovation next year of the Dalles on its 20th anniversary from 97 to today. But we are finding it slow going for approving new state veterans homes for that 65% funding out of the federal VA, out of current projected resources, whether in the president's budget or in future congressional action.
Sure.
So do they rate us based on, you know, like in terms of prioritizing those grants, you know, our capacity to serve in terms of the operational side, but also like just sheer numbers in Oregon? Because
Chair Lively, Representative Parrish, there is a metric that they use to see whether they would grant their 65%. If we wanted to put one in Albany and we have one in Lebanon, they have kind of rules and procedures that would preempt us from doing that, and they wouldn't incent that. But I think the more interesting discussion is we have skilled nursing bed capacity across the state, generally bipartisan support for trying to reduce that capacity and incent to make sure that financial model and works for skilled nursing facilities and to expand the continuum of care from home care to keeping folks independent to assisted living. I honestly think the next opportunity for a veterans home project will be not just a pure skilled nursing play, but more of an assisted care and skilled nursing care, because we are finding excess capacity today, and we would much rather see that existing capacity as community care for veterans paid for by the federal VA, but to take advantage of that and not have to have new construction when we are trying to reduce the size of the system overall today. Does that make sense?
It does. Is there a model out there where, like, if you're doing sort of a skilled, but and also just retirement's probably not the right way, but, you know, that definitely, like, that incorporates the spouse into that care-type facility at all?
Is so Chair Lively, Representative Parrish, spouses are eligible for to be residents at the veterans' homes, state veterans' homes. They do have a cap that it can't be more than 25% spouses, so it's kind of keeping it below that number. There are other models from the domiciliary to kind of addiction and treatment facilities, often through the federal VA. What we would have to pilot, and I think there would be, you know, it's kind of the healthcare transformation initiative, and I think there would be support from the federal VA, is for we get a per diem payment for skilled nursing. We would not be able to get a per diem payment out of the federal VA on other models that we would like to move towards. But they are often lower levels of care, savings both to state Medicaid and Medicare costs, as well as the federal match. It's a huge opportunity. I mean, we are essentially across the federal VA veterans home system where Medicaid and Medicare was 20 years ago, and we could pilot a lot of the savings that have gone on for all citizens in the veteran space and be able to deliver more benefits to veterans.
Last one on this is, so when we like go out, when we bond and give priority dollars for say higher ed, like say PCC wants to build a building, and we say, okay, the state will give you bond authority if you have a match. Does the federal government look at your grants and say, well, we already have our 35% lined up, so therefore you should prioritize your 65% like we would do to the local level? In turn, we would roll that up to the federal level? Like, would, if we were there and committed, would they speed up your money?
Chair Lively, Representative Parrish, that showing that you have that local match, whether at the state or a county level, is essential. But back to that prioritization, it often is once you are on the list, they have, when you have hit certain requirements, you are on the list and moving forward. So we are at that point today, but we are not, they are not moving many of that list up the line. So we are 100 plus, and it's a few handful of projects. And it feels sometimes politically driven, even back to congressional politics. So kind of a Florida gets that 10th veterans home, or the right, you know, Walla Walla coming online in Washington with a lot of strong support on the Senate Armed Services Committee. It's not purely political driven, but it's also sometimes that system of prioritization gets trumped.
I'll just use that $500 million budget that the Ben Bulletin
And there is, so we, our total funds budget, when you approve on Ways and Means, it's 400 and something million dollars. So I, in an editorial in the Ben Bulletin, I turned to my finance, I'm like, where are these millions?
Where are those millions?
Show me the money.
Yeah, show me the money.
Over $300 million of that is to pay off debt service on bonds for the home loan program, or expenditure authority for, you know, we are doing $70 million plus in home loans, plus the $260 million portfolio. It's a constant cycle, but that is not raw dollars.
We know
it's
that.
A benefit, but it's not veteran services in the purest form.
Anything else? Representative Escobar.
Yes, if we work with the federal government on the VA, the federal VA system, because Congressman Walden had a town hall meeting with veterans, and a lot of things came out. One that came out, I don't know if they're doing it up in this part of the country, but they were taking the one-on-one with the psychiatrist, putting them in a group in order to get more people through the system. Is that happening up here as well?
So Chair Lively, Representative Esquivel, where we have seen historically a lot of backlog on the claims side, the federal VA is beginning, we have righted the ship on the claims backlog. We're seeing a little bit of bubble on the appeals, but what you're referencing is a lot of frustration from veterans and their families with the CHOICE Act, both for kind of the timeliness of care within the health care, within the federal VA system, or the seamlessness of getting that care paid for and appointed in the community. Much of that is structural in terms of how the CHOICE Act was structured, that the federal VA has to implement it, but they have a number of adjustments to the CHOICE Act to make it a better, more veteran-centric system. But today, federal VA, very challenging system on healthcare to navigate within, and then imagine if they can't get you that provider or don't have that provider or can't do it within 30-day window of CHOICE Act, that you get handed over to what is TriWest as the deliverer of community care. And just like we've seen challenges on the retiree health care, when you don't have those major bases, whether the providers are signing up, whether they're getting timely payments, whether simply making appointments is easy, it has been a handoff from a very large bureaucracy to another very large bureaucracy. And that is the shift that we are seeing as we grow community care. So federal VA will continue to become the payer of care, and that is great for our veterans, especially when they don't have to haul to the major medical centers from rural Oregon. But it is a learning curve of a process where they have always delivered that care within and had fee basis. The CHOICE Act really set a new world that has been challenging. And out of the pilot on the incarcerated veterans, we've designated one of our program analysts that are trained as a VSO to be the incarcerated veterans outreach coordinator. We would see an opportunity for another statewide mission for a healthcare navigator, because the CVSOs and the statewide VSOs, we have a robust system on the disability compensation, but if you have a challenge on the healthcare side with federal VA across whether it's Portland, Walla Walla, Boise, White City, Roseburg, it is a challenge to get those issues resolved within that system without that advocate in your corner. And the VSO system truly isn't built to be that healthcare navigator. So we see a lot of opportunity on that front.
Well, something must be wrong, because this one individual started at Walla Walla, moved down to Southern Oregon, and they said they had to go back to Walla Walla. I mean, that system's wrong. I mean, that's ludicrous.
Chair Lively, Representative, some of the things we hear makes it feel like a catch-22 world, and it takes that advocate. When you have those, do feed them into us, and we will work our best to resolve them, but we need to find a better way to staff that advocacy, because it is not just the patient advocate within the federal VA system. Texas Veterans Commission, you know, every state's differently structured, and they don't have veterans homes under them. They're really more just a core vet services, but they have co-located a state healthcare navigator at the major medical centers so that you have that true, you know, outside the system, almost an ombudsman-like representation. If you know, they say it's going to be 12 weeks to get your prosthetic after an amputation, or if they say it's going to take, you know, you can't get off of this opioid and need that. So you have someone that can build the relationships long-term across a complex system and not let families and caregivers try to navigate it on their own.
That's critical.
And that models what we have done on the benefit side with claims.
Don't perish.
Can I switch you to a little bit different topic? The No Wrong Door legislation we've passed. I'm just sitting here as we're sitting here, and up pops an email from DMV a few minutes ago saying 89,000 names and addresses to ODVA since we passed the legislation. What are we doing with those 89,000 names, and are we like cross-referencing them to folks who are getting benefits and parsing out people who aren't, and then how do we reach out to the people that aren't?
So Chair Lively, Representative Parrish, there is always that initial outreach of the Veterans Benefit Magazine, but even finding it's getting to be a significant cost, given the paper and the mailing costs out of Hyde, trying to find, and you know, the more we can get to an email for these folks, the better off we will be. But both, whether it's out of DMV data or other state agency data or even the DHS, OHA, Paris data, as we identify more and more, beginning to, similar to the Incarcerated Veterans Project, beginning to pilot how do you get those contact names appropriately down to not just to know the universe of benefits, but again, to a veteran service officer. But it's not like VSOs across the state are, you know, Maytag's washing machine waiting for the next client. They have plenty of clients. So, I mean, at one level, this is an information game and an awareness game. We've doubled the number of claims from 6,000 in new claims in 2013, doubled that over the last 3 to 4 years off of $1 million surge down to the county level to help drive that.
Yeah. It's insane.
I mean, and then it results in $200 million extra every year of cash into the pocketbook and into the economy. And we know we are leaving that on the table. I would just say that county and statewide symbiotic, we still deliver local boots on the ground support to Marion and Polk County. Polk County will be coming on January 1, 2017, standing up a veteran service office. That allows us the flexibility to try to go to that incarcerated veteran person, to try to do the healthcare navigator. Not that that work is more important than the local claims, but we're not going to pull the rug out on 27,000 local veterans that live around our headquarters. But we need to continue to move to that higher level and continue to invest in those local CVSOs.
I think that just to the point I asked Representative Evans, you know, that screen had 10 FTE to get to 1,200 people. You got a list of 89,000 names outside the walls and who may or may not be getting benefits. And how do we get to the people that, you know, have said, I'd like to get information about how to do this? As we start to, you know, potentially plan for Measure 96.
And Chair Lively, Representative Parrish.
Try to figure out how we get the biggest bang for our buck.
I think on that slide, that is a significant new revenue scenario. If we are in a down budget for the 17-19, we are committed to our pilot projects, keeping them going as best we can. That is heavily emphasizing the, you know, finally, I mean, we have staffed now one of those VSOs regularly up at Coffee Creek to catch the names and make sure those folks are veterans and we got our little Excel spreadsheet. What we have proven over the last 3 years negatively is that it's very challenging for our county VSO networks to go into the prisons on a regular basis to do direct claims work for that middle portion that the veteran is incarcerated. Once we have identified them, we can have a handoff and even incorporate it into parole and post-prison work to make sure they go to via VSO. But it's very challenging to do the middle meat of the work. And that's where DOC was emphasizing. But for 14,000 Oregonians plus that are incarcerated today, they have about 2 staff members who do that work today for all of them. Now, it's a significant investment, but I don't question. We would see recidivism go down. It's that first year that folks get out of prison that's going to determine largely whether they are circling back, whether into local level jails or state prison system. We know if we can get more of those folks access to their benefits. It used to take how long to turn back on benefits?
9 months.
9 months for an incarcerated veteran because it was in the kit and caboodle of I got married, I had an extra dependent, I'm going on deployment. All of those all of them are important, but the federal VA had them all lumped together. They need to fix that system to be able to get more, all of those prioritized. But for the handful, 30 odd inmates every month that are coming out, get those prioritized if they have a benefit so they're not 9 months. They don't have that benefit and access. Yeah. And literally took just coordination and relationship by Mitch Sparks and the federal VA team to prioritize those, and it is down to 4 days. The switch is flipped for those folks coming out now on 4 days. And that didn't take any staffing. That didn't take any extra resources. So we have kind of a on fumes, out of hide model. We have an increased significant investment. But any one of you could find $1 million, and we would want to do student veterans, we would want to do homeless veterans, right. We would want to do mental health suicide prevention. So where we landed in our governor's budget, prioritizing student veterans, because we do so much trying to maximize this federal VA, but it doesn't honor the natural strengths that we know our veterans and military families have. If you strengthen that educational opportunity, they're going to go forth and conquer the world. Homelessness, it has risen of late, and we've had great track record with the Oregon Housing and Community Services and local grants down to community action networks. And then that last one, where we have leveraged the compensation and pension system to the tune of $1.3 billion of cash every year out of the federal VA, how do we better maximize the over a billion dollars of federal VA health care? So we would look at, you know, sometimes it's transportation to get them to the appointment, but that is keeping them off of Oregon Health Plan or other state Medicaid match services. What does it look like to have peer-to-peer mental health efforts in addition to a crisis line? So we have, the partnerships go quick, and our model is not to drive those. We would like to see those dollars pass through ODVA's budget, you know, through a veteran services fund for accountability, so Ways and Means can see it all, like what are we getting if that does pass. But we are not necessarily the deliverer. That might be special payments over to health authority and down to nonprofits, through Oregon Housing and Community Services and down to community action networks, through us over to community colleges or through higher ed folks. But it is, whether, and this is our $18 million of new ideas in our agency rec, regardless of the color of money, there is huge opportunities, but a lot of competing demands depending on a number of variables.
This is more a question for you. But is there a way, like House and Senate veterans after November 8th, before legislative days, can maybe come together with veterans groups and ODVA and actually start to prioritize that ahead of the 17 session? So it's not just a bunch of random individual bills, but maybe we have some solid ideas coming forward. That's a chair question.
You're on the spot.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a way. Nobody's talked about that, but that doesn't mean there isn't a way. That would be outside of the way the process normally occurs, but that's not to suggest there isn't a reason to have the conversations, and that ultimately it has to go through all the other processes we have here and that. But the further we can get ahead of the conversation and hopefully come around what might be some of the priorities, given all the range of things, then I think there's would be some in value in that. So we'll just have to talk about it and see.
Chair Lively, Representative Parrish, members of the committee, I think both for the policy committees are going to be potentially in a position to have a much louder voice on how to spend resources around veterans. The veterans community will have a much larger voice, and the more we can coordinate that, I mean, it's not like we haven't seen on Campaign for Seniors and Disabled, or try to get the united message of here are the best and brightest opportunities. So we would be happy to co-host. I mean, there's a bipartisan nature to this, even if it's just a listening tour to begin to get a better picture, kind of in a post-November universe. We'd be happy to help host and convene and get the word out and not make any promises, but simply hear what folks are thinking.
Rep. Evans has a task force.
I know.
Oh, task force.
And Chair Lively, members of the committee, really had to go to those task force meetings. Thankfully, my staff stepped up. But it literally was the most successful task force. We began implementing as soon as we had something identified. We were all huge support from Director Peters and DOC's team. Most often it's put it on a shelf, ideas that are too expensive to implement,
That's great. We appreciate that.
Sure.
Yes.
I think that we need to, and I'm not sure how you go about this since it is a federal system. And example, I have neuropathy from the diabetes that I received from Vietnam from Agent Orange. Well, I went to the doctor at the VA because they had to verify it, even though my doctor said you have neuropathy. So they do. That's fine. I get that part. But I said, well, are you going to put in for it? And he said, no, I can't. I said, what do you mean you can't? Well, it goes to a group of people in Portland, and they evaluate it, and then they take care of it. So we're just, why do we do things in that system like that? Why didn't the doctor be able to write out on a computer, send it back, and saying, this is the way this is because I'm the doctor?
Indeed, Cameron.
Chair Lively. I mean, do you have any idea of that thinking?
I'm going to recommend Rep. Esquivel's appointment to either the regional administrator for benefits for VA or the healthcare system.
Get me on the target.
Yeah, get him on there. I think that's a good idea.
It's amazing to me that the bureaucracy we built into the system.
It's no question about it.
Chair Lively, members of the committees, I think one of the root causes is that this is a federally driven system from the top down. Mm-hmm. You know, good luck. You know, we don't feel engaged back to Washington, D.C., to our electeds. We don't feel engaged to the staff of some of the federal agencies to find ways more and more to get that federal VA benefit, but pass through some other entities. And that will mirror some on the community care for healthcare. But it is, I mean, it's a top-heavy system to navigate.
Interesting how many congressional staffers we have sitting in a policy committee to plug in to what the concerns are at the state level to take to the feds. Wait, there are none.
There are none. Okay. No. Anything further for Cameron?
Thank you.
Thank you all. For,
I'm glad we got that on tape.
The smart alecky lives at that end of the dial. I see how that goes.
Here it is, 4:35 on Friday, and you can still...
It's comedy hour.
It could have been three if it hadn't been for Huffman, right?
Right. Sorry, Carl. Any further business?
I just will blame Evans because he's not here.
Any further business?
I just will blame Evans because he's not here.